You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
While the U.S. public is distracted by endless election circuses and the hunt for more bread, the U.S. military and NATO are stirring up World War III in Eastern Europe. Today we speak with Phil Wileto. He is editor of the Virginia Defender newspaper here in Virginia and a member of the Administrative Committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC. Phil Wileto, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you on. I know that you've been doing anti-war work for years, but you have been working with anti-war and anti-fascist groups in Eastern Europe lately, and you've been to Poland, and you've been to Ukraine, and you're going to Budapest, I think.
Right.
Talk about your trip to Ukraine in particular. What happened there?
Yeah, this has really been interesting. I don't do a lot of international traveling, but I was filling in for another UNAC member who was invited to attend the a conference in Poland, Wrocław, Poland, called the Social Forum of Eastern Europe and Cooperation Between East and South. It was basically a wide spectrum of left forces, from old communist parties, Trotskyist groups, social democrats, anarchists, everyone who was, basically opposed to the right-wing transformation of Eastern and Southern Europe. And when we were there, Anna Edwards, my wife, and I both attended the conference. We had a meeting with a group of folks from Odessa, Ukraine. They're called the Council of Mothers of May 2. And they are relatives or friends, supporters of at least 46 people who were murdered in Odessa a few months after the right-wing coup of 2014. And there was a clash between forces that opposed the coup and supported the coup. But there were also thousands of right-wing soccer fans in town that were whipped up to attack the anti-coup forces and chased hundreds of them into a five-story union headquarters, the House of Trade Unions, in a downtown area called Kulikovo Square. And they firebombed the building and shot people who tried to escape. Some people were leaping from the third or fourth stories and then were beaten with clubs when they hit the ground. It's called the worst incident of civil conflict in Europe since World War II. And so some people were burned to death, some died of smoke inhalation, some were shot, some were beaten. And there has never been a real investigation of who is behind this attack. And but there are just scores and scores of documentaries and raw video footage of the attack. Anybody who Googles May 2, 2014, Odessa can find them. And you can see the faces of people who are throwing the Molotov cocktails, who are shooting, who are beating. And you can also see pictures of people setting up little assembly lines to make Molotov cocktails, which is not something you carry in your back pocket normally. The electricity was cut off in the building. The water was cut off. It's pretty clear that there was some planning and organization behind this attack. And the family members have been pressing for an investigation ever since. And they also hold regular memorials in Kulikovo Square. They lay flowers and release black balloons as a symbol of mourning to press their demand for an international investigation. There have been several by prestigious organizations, the Council of Europe, the United Nations Human Rights Committee, but all have come to the same conclusion that the Ukrainian government is not cooperating in the investigation, and so there's really nothing that they can do without getting files and forensic reports and so on.
But when you really went there, Phil Wileto, when you went there was for the 2-year anniversary of this horror, right? And there were threats of new violence around that, around plans for the anniversary, right?
Yeah, it was a powder keg. The city government went to court to try to ban the memorial, saying that there would be violence. A half a dozen well-organized, well-funded fascist organizations were threatening a repeat of the massacre of 2 years before. The governor called on the president to send in the National Guard, which he did, and the section of the National Guard he sent was the Azov Battalion, which is the neo-Nazi organization that the U.S. helped incorporate into the National Guard. So they had set up roadblocks around the city to question people coming in. The federal state security unit, similar to the FBI, had closed down Kulikovo Square. They said there was a bomb threat. They said they had found explosives in the area that they were linking to the anti-coup forces. So there were people being stopped at the airport and held in detention and then deported. So it was a very, very tense situation. And this was why the Council of Mothers of May 2 had asked international observers from across Europe and the U.S. to come and stand with them on May 2nd on the theory that if there are foreigners present, that maybe the Ukrainian government and the U.S., which supports the Ukrainian government, really directs it, would hesitate to have a repeat of the massacre take place. And we also put together a big international support campaign. So it was a statement calling on the Ukrainian and U.S. governments to ensure the safety of the participants at the memorial. And within a matter of weeks, 180 organizations in 24 countries had signed the statement. And we hand-delivered it to the Ukrainian embassy in D.C. That was Anna Edwards with the defenders and Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst and now prominent anti-war activist, hand-delivered to the Ukrainian government and held a press conference. And the next day, a reporter from TASS attended the daily press conference at the State Department and asked the question, what about this memorial and the threats against it and the massacre and the investigation? And the deputy spokesperson, Mark Toner, went on record as saying that the U.S. condemned the massacre of 2014, supported efforts to hold a memorial and condemned threats against the memorial in Odessa and supported the call for a real investigation of the massacre. So that was kind of a breakthrough. The upshot of the whole thing was that thousands of people came out on May 2nd in Odessa, which is really what made the difference. There were supposedly 1,500 cops deployed, 500 members of the National Guard. There were fascist organizations, but they were vastly outnumbered, and they weren't able to do much more than have some symbolic show of force by marching through the crowd quickly. There were maybe a dozen arrests or so, but by and large, the day went off peacefully, and that was a great victory because it was a standoff between, you know, the fascist forces backed by the government and the anti-fascist forces, and the anti-fascist forces won. So it was a great victory and a real honor just to be there among these people who, you know, display such courage and determination in the face of such threats.
How do you know, Phil, that the United States helped this particular nasty unit be incorporated into the National Guard, as you mentioned, and that the United States government directs the Ukrainian government?
Well, okay, directing, that's, you know, my interpretation. But in a nutshell, for 5 years or so before the coup, the United States was funding a vast array of NGOs in Ukraine to promote, quote, reform. Reform of a formerly socialist country means privatization of state industries, deregulation of industry, and severe cutbacks in social programs like pensions and public housing and so on. And the Agency for International Development directed all of that. And the U.S. Undersecretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, gave a speech in front of a group of corporate sponsors in D.C. It was videoed and it's on YouTube, bragging that the U.S. has spent $5 billion in this effort. Now, she was actually present in Kiev during the demonstrations, the protest demonstrations that grew into violent attacks on the government that resulted in the president, the pro-Russian president, being driven out of the country and a pro-U.S. president being installed. She was not only there, she went out and passed out loaves of bread and cakes to the demonstrators as a show of solidarity. And there were overtly fascist organizations like a group called Right Sector that were visibly involved in those protests that became violent. The U.S. has been training Ukrainian soldiers. They just had a group in one of the army bases in Alabama to train them in the use of drones to intervene in the fighting in the Donbass area where anti-coup forces and pro-coup forces are duking it out. It may lead to a separation of that section of Ukraine. The U.S. Has other military trainers in the city and in the country. And Bruce Gagnon, one of the three of us who went to Odessa, he's the coordinator for the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He'll be one of the speakers at the World Beyond War conference that you're helping to pull together in D.C. In September. That I really encourage people to go to.
Right. Look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, I'll be there. And the defenders are finally plowing through our to-do list, and we'll be endorsing the conference and helping to promote it.
Thank you.
But Bruce says that the who's been following Ukraine for several years says that the special U.S. Special Forces trained the Azov Battalion, which was is a neo-Nazi organization that models itself after military units of the SS, Nazi SS in World War II. It even used the same symbols as one of the SS units as a shoulder patch, an arm patch, and they were allowed to keep that patch as when they were transitioned into the National Guard. And I saw members of that battalion in Odessa when we were there. It's sort of like the Klan in green uniforms. That's kind of the impression you get, except they're in better shape.
There were snipers that were part of the coup in the square in Kiev, and there were accounts of the U.S. supposedly training snipers in Poland. Do you know anything about that? You've been to Poland a couple of times as well.
Yeah, I don't know the specifics of that. There were snipers that fired on a crowd of demonstrators, and it was claimed that those were government snipers. And that greatly turned public opinion in favor of the demonstrators. And now there are various observers who are alleging that those were actually provocateurs. And certainly provocateurs has been over and over. Use of provocateurs has been a pattern by the fascist organizations. But I don't have any specific information on that.
Yeah.
If you step back from the picture a bit, you see that a president who was pushing for Ukraine to be economically integrated with Russia and its economic allies was ousted, and a president who wanted to orient the country to the European Union and NATO came to power and is carrying out the privatization and deregulation and cutbacks in social services program that the IMF has been demanding. So it certainly was in the U.S. interest that the coup took place. And you've got to kind of look at the breadcrumbs that get dropped from the whole, process to see the evidence, circumstantial evidence at this point that I know of, that the U.S. was involved.
Victoria Nuland's interest, not necessarily yours or mine, and a handpicked president who she named before the coup in phone calls that we can go and listen to on YouTube. I mean, I think the evidence of the U.S. role is overwhelming, and you've cited some of the key bits. But how can people in the United States help at all now in terms of solidarity with the people in Odessa, in terms of demanding responsibility for the coup, while one of the no doubt chief proponents is running for president of the United States. What can people do to get involved?
Well, there's one very easy and important thing. The Council of Mothers of May 2 has an online petition supporting their call for an international investigation of the massacre of May 2, 2014. And signing and promoting that petition is a real contribution. They really feel like there needs to be an international outcry in support of this. And people can find that petition by going on the website that that we set up following the trip to Odessa. It's called OdessaSolidarityCampaign.org. OdessaSolidarityCampaign.org. If you go on there, in the menu, there's a petition, and you click petition, and you come to their online petition, and you can sign it. And people could sign and promote it. That'd be a great. It really means a lot. If you're in Odessa, and there's no Western coverage of what you are doing, what you are facing, I mean, a couple of weeks after we were in Odessa, there was a court hearing for a guy who's been in prison since the massacre of 2014. And he was one of the people that was in the House of Trade Unions. And he was charged, he wasn't formally charged. He was suspected of doing something to instigate the incident. He was going to be released because no charges have been placed against him in 2 years. And so the three-judge panel had met to go over his case, and they were expected to release him. Again, on YouTube, videoed about 30 thugs, who I understand were members of the Right Sector fascist organization, come into the courtroom, and they barricade the door from inside. They put up a piece of plywood and chairs and so on. They block the door, and they're screaming and they're yelling, and they're facing the three judges who are defended by about a dozen cops who look pretty scared. And the fascists are screaming, "You let him go, we will burn down this building with you in it." And they put him back in jail.
Mm.
That's how much the rule of law means in Ukraine. And this is in Odessa, which is a city which did not support the coup. Even though it's two-third Ukrainian, about one-third ethnic Russian, it did not support the coup. The mayor didn't. These fascist groups have such power because they're, you know, in an alliance with the federal government that they can carry off something like this. And it's so the fact that the Council of Mothers and the population that was willing to come out in the thousands for the second anniversary memorial, the fact that they not only stand up against the fascists but are able to survive in this city, it's a certain break on this whole process of eliminating all opposition to the government and to the schemes of the IMF and to Ukraine's increasingly close relationship with NATO. So it's supporting the Council of Mothers and their call for an international investigation. It's supporting an anti-fascist struggle that is a some kind of a break against this right-wing process.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, David, you know that, you know, Europe has not been an area that I've been particularly involved in throughout my whole life. I mean, I did solidarity work with Vietnam and Cuba and Latin America and Africa, but I never, you know, it wasn't the priority. But having kind of slid into this area, it's increasingly obvious to me, and this is from talking to, you know, primarily leftists, but leftists who often don't agree on anything else. You think we're divided in this country. But they all agree that 25 years after what they call the transformation, what everybody calls the transformation, the collapse of socialism, that Eastern and Southern Europe have been reduced to virtual neo-colonies of Western Europe and the U.S. Their industry has been largely discouraged. They're seen as sources of raw material, purchasers, consumers of manufactured goods from the West, cheap labor. The classical relationship between the metropolitan and imperialist countries and the formerly colonized so-called third world, they're sinking deeper and deeper into poverty. more and more right-wing governments are coming to power, and oligarchs, people who profited from the transformation, from the privatization schemes and so on, are funding overtly neo-Nazi fascist organizations to intimidate opposition and kind of do a clean sweep of the region. The IMF comes in and says that you're in trouble financially, we'll give you loans, they do this in Ukraine, but you have to enact certain reforms. You have to sell off the rest of your state-owned industry. You have to sell off your public housing, which was heavily, heavily subsidized, and now people are being evicted from homes that they lived in, you know, for, in some cases, for 20, 30 years. It's a situation where the populations are very anxious economically, and just like in this country, they split. They go, some go to the left, some go to the right. Some support right-wing governments. Some are rethinking, you know, okay, we didn't like everything we had before under socialism, but, you know, we remember the good stuff, too. I mean, the free health care, the free education, the sense of community. A lot of people we talked, I was really surprised. A lot of people talked about how there was more of a sense of community in the old days. People seemed to care about each other. And now it's all money, money, money. That's all anyone is supposed to think about.
Yeah.
So it's a process, and as you look at the direction, the geographical direction of this process, it's ever eastward. So that Russia now its western borders are ringed by formerly socialist countries that are now members of NATO or partners with NATO, and there are military maneuvers taking place in Poland, in the Black Sea. They're feeling very, very threatened, and when they react, they're being accused of being aggressive, and that so-called aggression is used as justification for more build-up of NATO forces. Now, I was in Warsaw for the NATO summit. I didn't attend the NATO summit. I attended two anti-NATO conferences that then joined together in a march on the NATO summit. And
we had Joseph Gerson on this show, Phil, before that about his plans to go there. So I wanted to get your report afterwards on, you know, what happened, including how the people in Poland perceived it.
Yeah, it was. You want to go into that a little bit now?
A little bit.
It was interesting. The conferences were relatively small. One sponsored by the World Peace Council had about 85 people, and the other by No to NATO, No to War, No to NATO, that Joe is affiliated with, and also UNAC, was about 150. And they have political differences, mainly over their criticism or non-criticism of Russia. But they joined together in a united march, which was also joined by a local Food Not Bombs anarchist group. And they marched past the U.S. Embassy, where Ann Wright, former U.S. colonel and State Department official, who's now another prominent anti-war activist, gave a rousing speech. And then we finished up at a field near within sight of the NATO summit. And that's when I gave a talk. It seemed like every Polish cop in the country was in Warsaw that day. I mean, the city was locked down tight. There's a party called the Justice and Law Party that came to power last fall. Very right wing, very anti-immigrant, very prone, demanding that the U.S. the NATO forces be stationed in Poland. There were no incidents. But it was like marching in a police state. But they let it happen. You know, they didn't crush it. That probably would have been an embarrassment for NATO. It makes it look like they're undemocratic when they're trying so hard to get more integrated with the West.
Yeah.
But out of the summit, there was a deep escalation of the militarization of Eastern Europe, so that battalions, it's about 1,000 soldiers each, are being stationed in Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. So that's the Baltic countries formerly members of the Soviet Union that border, two of them border Russia and Poland. The U.S. is also, quote, rotating another couple of thousand troops in Eastern Europe, which basically means they're there. I mean, they say rotating so they can, so you won't think that they're establishing a military base. But they're not staying at Motel 6. I mean, you know, they got their own facilities and so on. So
yeah.
It's basically putting a U.S. base there. And one of the, and they brought in a new country, Montenegro, one of the Balkan countries, formerly part of Yugoslavia, into NATO, formerly incorporated in. And the thing about NATO is any attack on any NATO country requires response from all NATO countries. So you now got 29. You're not up to, with Montenegro. You have 29 countries in NATO. If any one of them gets attacked, the U.S. is committed to go to war.
Or,
and that's with Russia.
Or is alleged to have been attacked, which works just as well. Phil, we have about 2 minutes left, and I wonder if you could comment on the fact that not only are we not hearing about any of this in the U.S. corporate media, but it's being drowned out by the exact opposite, as you mentioned, tales of Russian aggression, Russian invasion of Ukraine, Russian threats to Europe, and so forth, to the point where you now have the Democratic Party demonizing Republicans and associating them with Satan himself in the form of Vladimir Putin, and you know, using red baiting in the way that it used to be the more right wing party in the United States did. What do you make of this phenomenon, and how do we deal with it here at home?
Well, trying to not sound rhetorical, I think that both the Democrats and Republicans are controlled by the same corporate interests. And they have the same international interests. It's only a question of how to achieve the goals. And Russia is a big prize. I mean, Russia has vast natural resources, you know, developed industry. It's an economic and political competitor with the West. I really don't think they want to go to war. I know a lot of people are talking about the possibility of World War III, but I'm not sure why, you know, capitalists would want to destroy a country that can be exploited. I think they'd rather create enough tension that hoping that the people of Russia will say, Jesus, we're going to wind up incinerated if we don't get a government that's more palatable to the U.S. Similar to what, you know, how the U.S. got rid of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua by promoting the Contra War to the point where people voted the Sandinistas out. I think that's a more likely scenario. But it could slip. It's extremely dangerous.
Right.
And the Russian people have been, you know, I mean, they remember the invasion of the Nazis. They're not giving in to the West. They're not going to allow their country to be dominated by Western powers.
Right.
So it's extremely dangerous.
When it comes to that, we have to be very, very lucky. And I wish we could talk about it for additional hours, but we are out of time. Phil Wileto, thank you very, very much for everything you're doing and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Appreciate it so much, David. We're not getting invited by the New York Times or the Washington Post, so the independent media is the way. We appreciate it so much.
Thank you. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the movement for Black Lives has never relied on corporate media to get their message out, but the coalition's newly released policy platform does provide an opportunity for journalists, sometimes given to ponder what Black activists are for, to engage those ideas. We'll hear about a vision for Black lives, policy demands for Black power, freedom, and justice from Ashley Woodard Henderson, organizer with Project South and with Concerned Citizens for Justice and part of the Policy Table leadership team of the Movement for Black Lives. Also on the show, when American firms dominate a global market worth more than $70 billion a year, you'd expect to hear about it. Not so with the global arms trade. That's the lead on a recent article by William Hartung. He's director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and author of, most recently, Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. We'll ask him how it is that we hear so little about an industry that's so big. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a very brief look back at the week's press. Big media are heralding a federal appeals court ruling striking down a North Carolina law that made it harder to vote. Harder for some, that is. The court noted that the restrictions on things like early voting and same-day registration targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision, and indeed came in the wake of the state's request for specific data on voting practices by race, which itself came in the wake of the Supreme Court's ruling in Shelby County versus Holder, saying that states with histories of discrimination no longer needed to get federal clearance for such changes. So it's great to see the New York Times, for instance, excoriating North Carolina Republicans' scurrilous attempt to suppress the rising power of Black voters. In a better world, of course, such campaigns would not have enjoyed years of tailwind from media like The Times, rhetorically balancing claims of potential voter fraud with evidence of actual voter suppression. And mindful of the paper's current note that court decisions like this one show the bitter struggle for basic fairness beyond the national spotlight, we'll look for media to report this story out, with follow-up on how, for instance, North Carolina will mitigate the inevitable confusion over the new exceptions, given that there's no funding for public education, as Samantha Lockman notes at Huffington Post. Or on how, as the nation's Ari Berman points out, this ruling poses a challenge to the Supreme Court's Shelby decision, premised on voter suppression as a thing of the past. Kristen Clark of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law reminded in testimony at the DNC how, after the 15th Amendment, states like Alabama introduced bans on voting by people convicted of felonies, along with purposefully ill-defined crimes of moral turpitude, in an admitted effort to disenfranchise Black Americans. These rules that prevent many who've served time in prison from ever voting again were also precisely crafted with a goal in mind, and even after the court's recent ruling, they're still achieving it. Media interest in the issue is welcome. We hope they'll remember that their spotlight is most useful where folks are still working in shadow. Finally, when former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg took the stage at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia to tout his nonpartisanship and call for a sane, competent person for president, we saw a celebration of conservative centrism on the floor and, as Molly Neffel noted for Fair.org, in the establishment media, reacting, after all, to a politician who is also a powerful establishment media mogul. You can feel the appreciation in Washington Post writer Jonathan Capehart's assessment of Bloomberg as political pragmatism personified. Capehart notes that Bloomberg was a Democrat who switched to Republican to run for mayor, then switched to independent when he thought about running for president. And he cites with admiration Bloomberg's statement that any successful elected executive knows that real results are more important than partisan battles and that good ideas should take precedence over rigid adherence to any particular political ideology. What results, or ideas exactly, Bloomberg can claim were of less interest to pundits than a game of who's the better billionaire. Wrote the Washington Post's Chris Saliza, Bloomberg found his mojo when he turned his rhetorical fire on Trump, and man oh man did he go after his fellow New York billionaire. K-Part 2 had cheered how Bloomberg slammed his fellow billionaire for his business practices that hurt real people. As Neffel notes, one of the policies Bloomberg is most proud of, stop and frisk, was overturned by a federal judge precisely because it hurt real people. Likewise, his policies on homelessness, namely eliminating permanent housing assistance programs that led to an 83% increase in the city's homeless families. During his tenure, Bloomberg proposed budget cuts to the fire department, elderly services, libraries, public schools, and recycling programs. And he cut child care and after-school programs for 5 years in a row. New Yorkers know this, though not thanks to Bloomberg's own media empire. Reporters at Bloomberg News are under a longstanding directive to avoid coverage of their boss, which translated into a virtual ban on investigative reporting of the mayor of New York for 12 years. But none of that changes national media's shorthand for the former mayor as a social liberal but a fiscal conservative, a supporter of the arts, and, strangest of all, the billionaire to root for. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The constellation of activists fighting racist police violence, especially visibly in the last few years, has seemed to confound corporate media. Who's really a member of Black Lives Matter? Why isn't there a single leader? What are they for, and why won't they channel their concerns through the electoral political system? Even before the likes of Bill O'Reilly declared that the killings of police officers meant that anti-brutality activists constitute a hate group, media elites have used such questions as reasons to dismiss the movement for Black Lives as not politically serious. The newly released policy platform, A Vision for Black Lives, Policy Demands for Black Power, Freedom, and Justice, calls media's bluff on the idea that they would engage these concerns if only they could see them articulated. But whatever media do or don't do, the platform is designed with bigger purposes in mind. Here to tell us more about it is Ashley Woodard Henderson. Ashley is part of the Policy Table leadership team of the Movement for Black Lives. She's a regional organizer with Project South and with Concerned Citizens for Justice. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ashley Woodard Henderson.
Hey, thank you.
What is this platform? Tell us about what went into it and what it does.
Sure. And thank you again for having us on so that we could talk about this really transformative document that folks from all over the country and internationally have had conversations about for over a year now. We really created the platform, the Vision for Black Lives, for three key reasons. One being to articulate and elevate a shared set of priorities that reflect the ongoing work of our people and serve as a tool for groups and individuals that are organizing for dignity and power of Black people in the U.S. and abroad. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that we were advancing a radical but really clear vision of the world that we want for our people, and not just for reforms that might be Band-Aids on the gaping wounds that our communities are facing.
Right.
We think that this platform really lays out steps that we can take to get us to the liberated communities that we want and that we're trying to build. We're trying to transform these communities. We're trying to transform how policy looks in the 21st century. And we do not want, you know, a tweaking of these existing systems or policy changes that don't address the root causes of the issues that we're facing. And then finally, we really wanted to make sure that we were intervening in the current political moment with an agenda that resists state and corporate power and increases the criminalization and surveillance of our people. We're seeing that happen dramatically across the United States. And we recognize that it's going to take a grassroots movement to save us, not just individual political parties or candidates. About a year and some change ago, back in July of 2015, we had a big Movement for Black Lives National convening that you and many of your listeners probably will remember. And we had about 2,000 Black people from all over the world show up. And it was really powerful because we asked if folks wanted to prioritize organizing and base building, if they wanted to prioritize direct action, political education, or talking about policy, creating and fighting for policy change. And what we were told by an overwhelming majority of those people is that they wanted us to prioritize all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we created some strategy sessions within the convening for folks to talk about the different issue areas that they wanted for us to be highlighting and lifting as we continued to collectively build, not individually or in silos or by individual organizations, but collectively as a united front build in this transformative movement. And so there was about 200-400 people in the policy strategy session, and they started the process of building the information that is now in this document. You know, over 30 organizations participated in the initial crafting of it, and I believe we're at 60 to 80 organizations have signed on to it since. Thousands of people are signing on to endorse it. And really what we did as a leadership team and then as the full policy table was synthesize all the information that we had heard from people at the convening that our individual organizations were working on the ground, either on the local, state, or federal levels, and then look for any gaping holes that we had missed that people were already doing on the ground.
Right.
We by no means think that this policy platform is going to be the one path to liberation, but we definitely believe that it is a strong, holistic first step, and we're looking forward to continuing to be engaged with communities as people use this as a tool to fight for really transformative change in their communities, and where we've left things out, create even newer documents that mm-hmm. are uplifting transformative policies that can be modeled in other communities.
Well, and one of the things that is so powerful about it is the way that it uplifts existing organizations. It's not about making something new or reinventing the wheel. I think that's good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. We clearly don't want to be alone in this work, and we don't have to be. And I think the Movement for Black Lives and as a whole, and the policy table in particular, is a manifestation of that desire that, you know, Project South and the Southern Movement Assembly say that we're stronger together, and it's not just a slogan. It is a fundamental fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing that manifested in the Movement for Black Lives and the policy table and the vision for Black Lives. It would not have been the same document had there not been activists and organizers and lawyers and economists and human rights activists and youth, immigrants, like all these different communities of people that were represented by the organizations coming together, representing thousands of Black people across the U.S. and for some of us internationally, to define and articulate a comprehensive visionary agenda. I think that we have been encouraging more and more people to see themselves as the Movement for Black Lives, right? Like we have never been trying to create something new. And in fact, this very platform is a manifestation of ongoing work that's been happening in the Black radical tradition and the Black liberation struggle before many of us were even born, right? It builds on the legacy of the Black radical tradition, including the work of the Black Panther Party, the Black Radical Congress, the Black Consciousness Movement out of South Africa, many, many others. And we see ourselves in the tradition of the freedom fighters that came before us.
Let me just ask you finally, I saw in one report the platform described as a pivot away from focusing on racist policing. It's not really a pivot away from. It seems to me to be a broadening, you know, a connection of that phenomenon, which was so salient and the focus for many people's energy and concern, just connecting it to the other things that it's naturally connected to.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we have always said that state violence was bigger than just police murdering Black people.
Right.
However, we cannot end state-sanctioned violence without dealing with policing in the United States. So obviously, ending the war on Black people, stopping the killing of Black people, especially at the hands of police and law enforcement, is critical to this platform. But we also recognize that even if we stop police brutality tomorrow, there would still be issues that plagued our communities. It's why we also lift up a call for reparations. It's why we also lift up divestment from the institutions that criminalize, cage, and harm Black people, and an investment in the education, health, and safety of Black people. It's why we call for economic justice for all and a reconstruction of the economy to ensure our communities have collective ownership and not merely access. It's why we ask for community control of the laws, institutions, and police that most impact us. And in fact, even stronger than asking it, we demand it.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, it's why we think that it's so important for there to also be a push for independent Black political power and Black self-determination in all areas of society. And so, again, you know, absolutely, we are still about the work of ending police brutality and sanctioned violence in our communities at the hands of law enforcement. But we know that we need a more holistic program to be able to actually see liberation for Black people in our lifetime. And so there's about 40 policy demands in the document. Folks can find it at policy.m4bl.org. And we are encouraging people to engage with it and see it as theirs. It's a tool for them to be able to take to their grassroots communities and fight for justice for Black people with some concrete transformative demands that we hope will actually change the material conditions of Black people in transformative and liberatory ways, and so much that we won't have to tear them down later. Like, that was actually a really critical piece for us in developing these policies, is that it wouldn't be things that harmed other people and that it would transform the way that Black people are treated and increase our ability to thrive and live in our full dignity and humanity in the United States.
We've been speaking with Ashley Woodard Henderson from Project South and Concerned Citizens for Justice. Again, you can find the policy platform of the Movement for Black Lives online at policy.m4bl.org. Ashley Woodard Henderson, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
We appreciate you for having us.
American media love the rich. Besides constant, assiduous attention to the things they buy and eat and wear, we see lists of the richest people alongside numbers indicating what we straightforwardly refer to as their worth. Of less interest is how the rich got and stay that way. And the same holds true for corporations, which of course are a big part of how rich people got and stay that way. Success is success, after all. And for all the tales of a muckraking media, our guest's experience suggests that when it comes to one of the most stupendously successful U.S. industries, the press corps don't seem all that eager to look behind the curtain. William Hartung is director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and a senior advisor to the Security Assistance Monitor. He's a regular contributor at TomDispatch.com, for which his most recent piece is called "There's No Business Like the Arms Business. Weapons Are Us, But You'd Never Know It." He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, William Hartung.
Thanks for having me.
Well, some listeners may have seen this Lisa Rhine piece in the Washington Post recently. It was about how costs for some Defense Department program to maintain vehicles for Afghanistan's military have doubled to hundreds of millions of dollars because of some Keystone Cops kind of failures in oversight. And these are costs, of course, that taxpayers will bear. We hear these kinds of stories sometimes. Some listeners might remember the $640 toilet seat that the Pentagon bought. And we should hear these stories. But those kinds of stories might leave the impression not only that things usually go right, but that things going right is cause for celebration. And so it's very interesting that the focus of your latest piece is on how news media approach the arms industry on a regular day, if you will, and whether that coverage is really commensurate with the power of the industry. What is your sense of that?
Well, I mean, it's a $70 billion industry, and the U.S. dominates it year after year. And a lot of these things, of course, are being used in places like Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, where a lot of groups think they've committed war crimes. So you would think this would be subject ripe for regular coverage. But what usually happens is the government puts out some statistics every year about who ranks where in the global arms trade. The Times, Washington Post, maybe AP do a story. And other than episodic little mentions in other stories, that's usually it, which is quite extraordinary given the impact that the trade has, not just economically, but on people's lives.
Well, maybe there's the rub. I mean, in some sense, it seems that it is drawing a direct connection between the impact on people's lives and the industry that maybe journalists on some level don't want to do. You know, I mean, in a way, there's a tremendous pretense, you know, that you talk about in the piece, that you sort of act as though it doesn't affect your ideas about policy, the fact that the country and particular corporations make so much money from selling bombs. You know, how can we not connect that to how hard we fight for diplomatic measures? I mean, those ties are crucial, it would seem, to make.
Yeah, and there's a whole ideology about the arms trade when it is discussed at all, which is that somehow we're helping people. Mm-hmm. You know, we're creating stability, and the arms are less likely to be used, and countries like Iran will do less nefarious things if we arm the Saudis. And it's been quite the opposite. I mean, Saudi Arabia has been killing civilians, using cluster bombs, fighting one of the most egregious wars in Yemen that we've seen in a long, long time. So it's far from stability. But what it is a steady source of income for companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, and they're kind of part of the push for making these things happen, usually hand in glove with the government.
Well, I remember you were saying years ago that part of what sustains the status quo, despite, you know, the occasional calls that we do hear to cut military spending or to cut back on weapons programs that seem to be duds, you know, but part of the issue is the way the benefits are so distributed throughout, not to put too fine a point on it, throughout congressional districts, you know, so that it's not so simple as to simply say we should stop making this certain kind of fighter plane because the making of it is so widely distributed throughout the country.
Well, that sort of political engineering is done on purpose, and it's done to kind of weave these programs into the economy in such a way that a lot of people will be affected, a lot of members' districts, and so forth. For arms sales, tank sales to Saudi Arabia are helping keep plants in Ohio and Michigan running. A new sale to Kuwait will help Boeing keep a plant going in Missouri. So these are important states. There, some of them are swing states, and you wouldn't likely see a president hold back on this kind of thing in an election year, although Obama has been a little slow on the sale to Kuwait, so I don't know if common sense has interceded or if it's a bureaucratic issue.
But it does make those ties hard to trace, I think, for sort of the layperson to try to figure out why is it not so simple to say, let's just stop making, you know, this certain fighter plane that it seems like we're never going to use again. Well, the tendrils of it reach quite far.
Yeah, we'd have to break through the current Congress and actually invest in some things that the country needs. Mm-hmm. In order to create alternative jobs. And with Congress not willing to make public investments, then it's much harder to get around that dependency on arms exports and military spending.
Well, let me ask you about Obama's particular legacy on this. Is something you also talk about in the piece. Where does he fit in terms of arms sales globally for the U.S.?
Well, the Obama administration has brokered more big arms sales than any administration since World War II. It's sort of neck and neck with Richard Nixon during the OPEC oil crisis when they were trying to recycle petrodollars by selling as much as they could to the Middle East. So it's partly they're pushing exports in general. It's partly that he wants to keep fewer boots on the ground than Bush did, and therefore he's using arms and training and special forces as an alternative way to intervene. So he's got a couple rationales, and you know, you'll see it periodically. When the Iran nuclear deal happened, he had a meeting at Camp David to try to get the Gulf Cooperation Council on board, and he said the U.S. would reassure them, and that reassurance came in the form of all kinds of arms sales. So it's used as a diplomatic tool as well.
Well, you note also in the piece that there have been, it's not just a matter of amount, but that certain restrictions and processes of scrutiny that were in place have been loosened, have they not, under Obama?
Yes. This was a longstanding goal of industry, and they couldn't get it through for probably a couple of decades. But what they've done is, for one thing, they've taken things that were on what's called the munitions list. Obviously, weapons have to be licensed by the State Department, and they've moved a bunch of those to the Commerce Department's jurisdiction. Commerce is mostly involved in pushing exports, not keeping track of things like are they going to human rights abusers. So that alone, I think we'll see the impacts going forward to the future, that it'll be easier for dictators or human rights abusers or countries that are on the terrorist list by the United States to find roundabout ways to get their hands on U.S. arms components and U.S. weapons.
Well, finally, media sort of whistled past what could have been a usefully uncomfortable moment when the head of CBS, Les Moonves, said Donald Trump was bad for the country but good for CBS. You know, it seems like dealing with the fact that companies can profit from things that we might consider to be or do consider to be social ills, we just, as journalists, I mean, don't you think that journalists simply have to dig into that? It seems as though it's kind of underestimating your audience to think that they can't handle the truth of the various motivations that governments and corporations use when they make choices.
Absolutely. And, you know, you don't see a lot of discussion of the consequences and the connection to that the arms are coming from the United States. So unless you read around in many different sources, you don't get the full picture of what a devastating trade this in and responsibility of our government and our corporations for keeping it running. And, you know, you'll see, in a book by a mainstream journalist, I'll get into some of this, but it rarely makes it into the newspaper. So then you have to go to the independent press or some of the specialized publications, and the average citizen doesn't have the time to do that. So it's just not on the public agenda the way it should be. And regular press coverage would help make that happen.
We've been speaking with William Hartung of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His most recent book is Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. The article, There's No Business Like the Arms Business, Weapons Are Us, But You'd Never Know It, can be found on tomdispatch.com. William Hartung, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Yes, thanks for having me again.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, traveler. Can you handle the truth? I didn't think so. Me neither. But it will happen anyway. Science is beginning to prove we have already changed the planet's climate in dangerous ways. A small group of climate scientists, backed by a billionaire and big oil, are considering taking over control of the climate to stave off disaster. Then we'll find proof our current 400 parts per million will melt so much Arctic and Antarctic ice, warming up to 8 degrees C, that global coasts will flood the world's largest cities. We'll wrap up with one of the few positive alternatives growing in this disturbed scene, a wake of bike sharing around the world. It can work. Gather round, boys and girls, as we tell the story of Earthmasters, the men who would take over from nature to run the climate of the world. Or do they mean to save us from our fossil-addicted selves? For all who love a good conspiracy, geoengineering has it all, the oil companies, far-right think tanks, nuclear weapons scientists, and even Bill Gates. But you have to hang in a little bit while we first look at a few small problems in their plans. Our guide is Clive Hamilton. After careers in the Australian Public Service as an economics and resource advisor and several stints at universities like Yale, Cambridge, and Oxford, Hamilton founded and ran a progressive think tank called the Australia Institute. Now he's professor of public ethics in a program run by two Australian universities. You may have heard of books Clive has written or co-written, including Growth Fetish, Affluenza, Silencing Dissent, and more recently, Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change. But his latest book is Earthmasters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering. We've reached Clive Hamilton in Canberra. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
Well, it's good to connect with you, and I begin maybe a little facetiously by saying your book is full of some great news. It's a real relief. We just have to pump a bit of sea salt into the air, and we can go on burning fossil fuels as before, even if we double the CO2 in the atmosphere. What are some scientists proposing to stop global warming? Try and make a little case for them.
Well, the idea of geoengineering is now come onto the international climate change agenda because the climate scientists themselves became very worried at the failure of the world to respond to their warnings. So the argument is that if Plan A, reducing global greenhouse gas emissions, isn't working, shouldn't we have Plan B? And that's where they started to develop these geoengineering ideas, a whole string of technologies that would either suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere or to put some kind of solar shield between the Earth and the Sun to cool the planet by basically reducing the amount of sunlight that reaches planet Earth.
Well, it's that latter one I want to talk to you most about, solar radiation management. Who named it that and did he come up with another name for it?
Well, there's one of the more prominent scientists involved in researching geoengineering, Ken Caldera at Stanford University, came up with the term solar radiation management, although more recently he's decided that perhaps sunlight reflection methods would be a term that would less likely frighten the horses. He came up with that term, he wrote, because talking about geoengineering would be too scary for some bureaucrats, and he was wanted to get some money to hold a seminar at NASA, and he was worried that geoengineering or climate engineering might make them a bit afraid, so he came up with his idea of solar radiation management. But of course, as soon as you think about it, managing the amount of solar radiation which reaches planet Earth, I mean, that's a pretty scary thought. And when you consider the primary method that is being put forward, it becomes scarier. And that method is essentially to surround the entire Earth in the upper atmosphere with a layer of so-called sulfate aerosols, tiny particles, essentially a kind of pollution, same kind of pollution that causes acid rain, but this time way, way up in the stratosphere. And because it's a pollution, these tiny particles would basically, depending on how much you put up there, reduce the amount of incoming solar radiation by perhaps 1 or 2%, thereby cooling the planet.
Isn't that the same as happens when volcanoes go off?
It is, and in fact, the idea for sulfate aerosol spraying as a method of geoengineering was prompted by observations over 100 years or more of the impact on the Earth's climate of major volcanic eruptions. Mount Pinatubo, for example, in 1991 in the Philippines, was a massive eruption, and it put so much volcanic ash and other particles and soot into the atmosphere that once it had circled the globe, it cooled the planet for half a degree or more for a couple of years. So that gave rise to the idea of, well, what if we could control the amount of this kind of sulfate aerosol in the upper atmosphere, say, with a fleet of specially equipped aircraft that would go up on a regular basis and spray the precursor chemical, sulfur dioxide or sulfuric acid, which would then in the upper atmosphere form sulfate particles and basically put a kind of thin shield around the Earth, which then whoever controlled it could turn up or down to offset the impacts of warming due to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Well, right, but then the next point you raise, I believe you used the term spine chilling, is what happens if we succeed in cooling the planet but then can't manage to keep the program going. You used the year 2059, I believe. What happens?
Well, this is one of a string of fairly frightening possibilities arising from sulfate aerosol spraying. A lot of modelling work has been done using big global climate models, but there has been no testing of it yet. One of the difficulties is that if we did, we, the global community, and, you know, there is a question of whether it would be the global community that did it or one power, China or United States maybe, but if we, the global community, decided to do it, we would need to do it for at least 10 years before we had enough data to be able to separate out the effects of sulfate aerosol spraying from the effects of global warming and natural climate variability. But building on that, the whole point about solar radiation management is it's not trying to counter human-induced climate change, but simply to deal with one of the symptoms. Okay, so one of the symptoms of human-induced climate change, and you know, the main one, is a warming globe. And so rather than tackle the source of the problem, that is burning fossil fuels and putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, sulfate aerosol spraying would try to counter one of the impacts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So basically it's suppressing the warming that's happening. It's countering it by putting this solar shield around the Earth. And so the question is, well, if we had to stop, if we had to take down the solar shield for some reason, maybe there was a really big unintended consequence, like it had a major effect, negative effect on rainfall patterns around the world, or let's say there's a big international conflict about the solar shield and it was stopped. We stopped sending the planes up, we stopped spraying the sulfate aerosols, and within a year or so, all of these sulfur particles fall out of the upper atmosphere. The problem is that we'll then have decades and decades of suppressed warming. Let's say we turned it off in 2060. We'd have decades of suppressed warming as we continue to pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, if indeed we did do that, and then there would be a huge rush of this warming that would happen very, very quickly. And as you know, the damage to ecosystems from global warming is due more to the rapidity of warming rather than the amount of warming, because if it's faster warming, ecosystems have less time to adapt. So this whole question is called the termination problem. Could we, once we'd started, could we actually terminate it, or would we be locked into this solar radiation management virtually in perpetuity?
Right, for generations to come. You mentioned rainfall, and you go into some detail in the book Earthmasters about the possibilities of rainfall changing in big ways. Could you talk to us for a minute about that?
Well, one of the big rainfall or precipitation events in the global climate system is, of course, the so-called Indian monsoon, which happens with great regularity each year and which is obviously crucial to irrigated agriculture over a vast swathe of the Indian subcontinent. And so a billion or more people depend on the Indian monsoon for their food supplies. One of the modelling studies using these global climate models looked at the impact on precipitation around the world of sulfate aerosol spraying and concluded that it's possible that the change to the global weather patterns as a result of sulfate aerosol spraying would be to shift the Indian monsoon, essentially from over India, Pakistan, sort of southwest over more towards Africa. And if that were to happen, of course, there would be a great drought in those regions and potentially severe effects on food supplies. I should say other modelling studies have suggested that that probably won't happen. But the fact that this is a possibility really opens up some very worrying implications and really points to the question of, well, who would control the global climate? And this question of governance, we're not even at that stage of thinking seriously about it yet. But given that global warming is continuing apace, the growth of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is accelerating, the prospect of engineering the climate is a very real one, and it's time now, and in a way this is why I wrote my book Earthmasters, for the world community to get involved so that if a time does come where it's seriously considered to take control of the Earth's climate, then it's not just the powerful few that have a say, but the world community as a whole.
Yeah, should it be Dick Cheney or perhaps the leader of North Korea? It's pretty hard to decide who in this world is ready to control the climate. Why can't we experiment with this first in some faraway part of the world to see whether the theory works?
For other geoengineering techniques, and I should say that sulfate aerosol spraying is kind of the headline technology, but there are a number of others which are being tested in various ways, less scary ones in some cases. But sulfate aerosol spraying, really, you can't test it because to see what effect it would have on the global weather patterns and certainly on the Earth's temperature, you can't do an experiment. You have to actually do it. You have to do the lot. You have to put up the sulfate aerosol shield and see what happens. So if you just went up over the ocean somewhere and sprayed some sulfuric acid into the upper atmosphere, I mean, it might tell you, be very valuable, telling you something about the chemistry of the upper atmosphere and whether the aerosols do form and in the way anticipated, but you couldn't find out what impact sulfate aerosol spraying would have on the global climate, on warming, on precipitation, on the ozone layer, for example, without actually implementing the scheme as a whole. So if we ever do it, it will be a gamble because we'll never really know with a great degree of confidence how it will work until we've actually done it.
Clive, does that mean we can't do regional climate control? Like, for example, some are advocating we could do it to save the Arctic sea ice.
No, well, some are advocating that. I mean, some serious people are advocating that. Not only are they advocating it, they're saying we should be doing it now. We should be doing it to slow down or prevent the melting of the sea ice in the Arctic. The problem, of course, is that if you go up there in the Arctic, high up, and spray sulfate aerosols, well, you know, they soon start blowing around the world and dispersing, and so you have to have a continuing program of spraying sulfate aerosols over the Arctic, which protects the Arctic for a while, but you know, very soon, within days or weeks, it gets blown around the world. And so it's very difficult to really isolate a particular area and to concentrate the activity on deflecting solar radiation from a particular part of the world.
This is Radio EcoShock with Clive Hamilton, an Australian intellectual and author of the new book, Earthmasters. I'm Alex Smith, and yes, we are talking about geoengineering to save the world, maybe. Clive, there's an old saying, you can't tell the players without a program. Your book has a pretty good outline of the people and institutions championing man-made climate control. Why not tell us about two of the key movers, Ken Caldera, who you've mentioned, and David Keith? Who are they?
Ken Caldera and David Keith are extremely well-regarded and accomplished climate scientists. Ken Caldera, as I mentioned, is at Stanford, and David Keith is at Harvard, formerly at the University of Calgary for many years. And they are extremely active in the geoengineering research arena, to the point where an earlier author dubbed them the geo-clique. And they are extremely active. They're very concerned about climate change, and which is why they are investigating geoengineering. Although, as I explain in the book, I think both of them have some kind of odd attitudes to global climate change. But one of the reasons why they're so important is that some years ago they became the principal advisors on climate change to Bill Gates. And Bill Gates was so impressed with their intelligence and commitment that he allocated several million dollars to a fund to conduct research into geoengineering technologies. So Caldera and Keith have been administering this fund for research, and it has also led, their influence has led Bill Gates himself to start investing in a number of companies which developing geoengineering technologies. One of them, for example, one of the companies that he's associated with is called Intellectual Ventures. The CEO is a man called Nathan Myhrvold, who was formerly the chief technology officer at Microsoft. Another man associated with Intellectual Ventures is named Lowell Wood. Now, Lowell Wood is an extremely interesting character. He was for many years, decades, until he left fairly recently, one of the gurus of weapons research, nuclear weapons research, at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of the two major Cold War weapons research laboratories. Livermore is located outside San Francisco. Lowell Wood was the protege of Edward Teller, the so-called father of the hydrogen bomb and one of the foremost Cold War architects. And so Lowell Wood and Edward Teller were responsible not only for Star Wars, the ill-fated venture for a missile shield, which the US could use space-based missile shield to defend against or indeed attack the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but they also, in the late 1990s, Lowell Wood and Edward Teller wrote one of the very first papers on geoengineering. And so in the book, I investigate the kind of links between geoengineering and Cold War thinking. If you reflect on it a bit, here we have with geoengineering, potentially at least, a vast technological plan to take control of planet Earth. This is in the grander designs. There are much more localized and benign forms of geoengineering to which this kind of analysis doesn't apply. But when it comes to sulfate aerosol spraying, you've got what I call a sort of Promethean vision to use technology to control nature, not just bits of nature, not just ecosystems or a river system or, you know, with a dam or something like that, or to carve out new ports using nuclear explosions, which Edward Teller was very keen to do, but to actually take control using technology of the planet's operating system in its entirety. And so in a way, this is my main concern, that in some parts of the geoengineering community, there is this Promethean ambition for control. I should say that there are others in the United States, and more particularly in Europe, who take a very different view of geoengineering. Even though they support research into geoengineering, they're far more humble, far more circumspect, far more worried about unintended consequences and the political misuse of geoengineering. So in a way, there's a kind of split within the geoengineering community between those who are very worried, in fact terrified about climate change and think with heavy hearts that we have to investigate Plan B, and others who get very excited about Plan B because they see it as the opportunity for mankind, and I use the word deliberately, to use our unique position, our technological genius, to finally take control of the Earth and subdue it.
Ah, we become the Earth Masters. Well, there's others waiting in the wings. I could see how this would really benefit the oil companies. They could keep on selling their products. What multinational oil companies are already involved in the geoengineering scene?
Well, of course, the oil companies and other fossil fuel companies realize they have to be very careful here because, like national governments that could be reducing carbon dioxide emissions but aren't or are only pretending to, the oil companies can be accused of trying to essentially torpedo Plan A, reducing carbon dioxide emissions, by promoting this bright, shiny Plan B. Nevertheless, the oil companies have quietly started to take an interest in geoengineering. ExxonMobil, for example, and there's no company or indeed organization in the world that's done more to try to undermine the credibility of climate science and to stop nations, particularly the US, from adopting policies to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. But ExxonMobil has an expert named Haroon Keshki, has an expert in geoengineering who's quietly been participating in task forces which looking at geoengineering and advocating more research. Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, is supporting research into geoengineering technology known as ocean liming. ConocoPhillips is supporting in Africa and elsewhere another geoengineering technology called biochar, a more benign technology compared to sulfate aerosol spraying, much more benign, and a lot of environmentalists support biochar. But the fact that ConocoPhillips is putting quite a lot of money into developing biochar as a kind of plan B for global warming certainly should set some alarm bells ringing.
Even the American Enterprise Institute, which took big oil money to deny climate change for years, has come out in favor of geoengineering, you write. For what? For a problem that doesn't exist? Help me, Clive. My brain is melting trying to make this connect.
It is very bizarre, isn't it? Until you start to think about it more carefully. So here we have these right-wing think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, which for a decade or more has been actively working to repudiate, undermine, deny climate change science. And whenever any measure, state or national, to reduce carbon dioxide emissions has been put forward, has embarked on a campaign to attack it for all usual right-wing reasons about government control and environmentalist secret agenda and so on and so forth. And so here you have them, nevertheless, supporting geoengineering. And the reason for it is that geoengineering sort of reverses the whole problem of human-induced climate change. Geoengineering, when it's put forward as a substitute for cutting carbon emissions, promises to turn a drastic failure of the free enterprise system into a triumph of human ingenuity. So instead of climate change being a vindication, a terrible vindication of the warnings of environmentalists, geoengineering exposes the lack of faith of environmentalists in humanity's ability to use its technology to solve these problems. So for organizations like the American Enterprise Institute, geoengineering doesn't represent the danger of technological hubris, but is an expression of human mastery over nature. So you can see how geoengineering, as opposed to reducing carbon dioxide emissions and shifting to renewable energy technologies, represents an affirmation of their view of the world, of humankind, of the free enterprise system. It's a sort of bizarre twist. So here we have these organizations which for years have been vigorously arguing that there is no such thing as human-induced climate change, and then along come these proposals for geoengineering as a response to human-induced climate change. They say, that's the kind of cure to a problem which we previously said didn't exist, but that's the kind of cure we're willing to swallow. So let's have some.
We are talking with author Clive Hamilton about his new book, Earth Masters, and due to time limitations, we won't be going into the technologies to suck carbon dioxide out of the air. People, you're going to have to buy the book to get that. But Clive, I would love to see you write a series of popular articles from this book to get these facts out more widely, or have you already done that?
I've done a few, and they can be found on the internet. I'm also going to be doing a tour in the United States and Canada in the next two or three weeks, and so I imagine more of those kinds of articles will be appearing in easily accessible formats for people.
His website is clivehamilton.com. The book is Earth Masters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering from Yale University Press. I admit it made me so angry at one point I had to toss it down partway through and go out for a walk. But Clive, you're very patient as you explain some of these kind of crazy things that are going on.
behind the scenes. It's gathering a lot of momentum as the climate science becomes more alarming and we go into a next warming spike. The calls to geoengineer the planet will become public and loud, and we need a really vigorous public debate so that it's not left to the powerful to protect their interests at the expense of everyone else.
Listeners, now it's up to you to spread the word about this and get people educated, because in his book, Clive shows polls that say most people don't even know this is happening, that the debate is even happening, and we need to know more about it. I'm Alex Smith. I highly recommend you follow up with Clive Hamilton's book, Earthmasters. Thank you so much, Clive.
Thanks, Alex.
In the last year, scientists discovered a climate record going back over 3 million years, long beyond the ice core records of 800,000 years. Research led by Professor Julie Brigham Grett from the University of Massachusetts Amherst drastically changes our understanding of the world. Drilling into a lake in the Russian Arctic created from a meteor strike ages ago, she found several periods, where the Arctic was up to 8 degrees warmer than today. That despite carbon dioxide levels thought to be similar to or below today's 400 parts per million. The Greenland ice sheets have repeatedly shrunk to half their current size. The West Antarctic ice sheet completely disappeared 1.1 million years ago. The sea level was tens of meters higher than today. All this, not with carbon levels like the 600 parts per million and above, projected by politicians and planners as we burn fossil fuels, it appears we may have already arrived at greenhouse gas levels sufficient to drastically warm the poles, make sea ice history, melt Greenland and parts of Antarctica, and flood coastal areas around the world. All that may only be a matter of time. Here is a selection of key clips recorded from a YouTube video presentation by Dr. Julie Brigham Grett at Amherst in the summer of 2012, almost a year ago, and yet hardly anyone has heard of these startling findings.
So everything you see here in this diagram from stage 5 on is absolutely new. No one's ever seen this before in the Arctic in a continuous record from the land. We know from looking at this stage 5 here, 125,000 years ago, the Arctic was a little warmer than now. Globally, we were 1 or 2 degrees warmer than present. The Arctic may have been 2 or 3 or 4 degrees warmer than present. And scientists agree now that the Greenland ice sheet at that time was probably 40 to 50% of its present size. So we can see what the Arctic does in a warmer world. So let's look at stage 11 at 410,000 years ago. And if we take this little interval right here and expand it out, this goes from 450,000 to 380,000 years here. So we've blown up stage 11. So let's look at that in terms of the vegetation around there. And on the left, I have color-coded. The red here is just trees and shrubs. When there's lots of trees in the Arctic, you know it's got to be warm. And the cooler intervals here in blue. So this is, again, stage 11. This is the pollen, preservation of the pollen that records the vegetation at the time by Pat Anderson at the University of Washington and Tolya Loshkin in Magadan. Their pollen records then have been transferred into a biomodel by Pavel Terezov, which allows us then to reconstruct paleo temperatures. And what this shows is that through the interval of stage 11, the climate was in fact 8 degrees warmer than present in summer. That's astounding. Nobody's ever seen this before. So this was astounding. That not only was it warm, it was warmer than 5E when that previous interglacial. This is not what we had expected. Let's look at another one here. This now is in the center of this long stack from 3.6 million down to the present. And here we're looking at an event at 1.1 million called Marine Isotope Stage 31. We highlighted this because we knew from the Anduril record in Antarctica that during this time, this was the last well-documented time when the West Antarctic ice sheet had disappeared. So we wanted to say, well, what happened in the Arctic at the same time? What happened at the other end, at the other polar region? So we went in and looked at that particularly warm interval. And here again is a similar diagram, the paleomagnetic stack, and take this tiny interval here and expand it out. We looked at the pollen again, looked at the biome data, and again we got summer temperatures that are in excess of 6 or 7 degrees warmer than present. Not quite as warm as stage 11, but certainly much warmer than present during this time. So what can we gather from stage 31? Why was it warmer? What was driving that? It's very difficult. Once we go beyond the Epica ice cores, back beyond 800,000 years ago, we don't have a direct measure of CO2. So other scientists like Panusha here at Lamont Doherty has produced a paper where she suggested in stage 31 that the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere may have been in the range of 300 to 325. There's some error bars on those estimates. So it's possible that the carbon dioxide of the atmosphere was warmer during this particular time. We would expect a normal interglacial level to be about 280 parts per mil. So this is a little warmer, a little higher than what we would expect. If we look at from the southern hemisphere to the equator to the northern hemisphere here, we can also see that due to the changes in the Earth's orbit, the orbit around the sun, the tilt of the Earth, and the season in which we're closest to the sun, those influence also the energy coming into the upper atmosphere. And we can see that, in fact, during this stage 31, that, in fact, we were getting about 50 watts per meter squared greater input from the sun at that time. So we could see that there was a Milankovitch, shall we say, or orbital forcing part to this. So we wanted to then say, well, how does that link with Antarctica here? But I want you to notice that, look, there's several places here going back, and there's this M2 interval is at 3.2 million, when there are other times when the West Antarctic ice sheet disappeared. Now, this was an amazing accomplishment for Andrill to be able to demonstrate that the West Antarctic ice sheet was not a stable phenomenon, that, in fact, it is vulnerable and able to come and go. Let me bring that back to Lake Elgigikin now. This diagram is simply our proxy going back from 0 to 2.8 million. And if we zero in on this one, this is stage 31, stage 11, the last interglacial here, and the Holocene, the last 10,000 years, comparing these four different warm periods. What I want to bring your attention to is this diagram shows changes in vegetation, but down here is a biome reconstruction of the July temperature for these four different interglacials, and we're living in this one right now. And then this is also mean annual precipitation. And what I want mainly to see here is that both isotope stage 31 and 11 were much warmer and much wetter than anything we've seen in the Arctic before. This is an absolutely unprecedented record. We didn't expect it, and it certainly was a big surprise for us to see this, but it certainly seems to be holding up really well. So what it means is that Greenland is not only just this ice sheet that sits there no matter what the North Atlantic does. In fact, probably comes and goes and has come and gone much more frequently than any of us had imagined. Now, stage 11 and 31 are not isolated. There are other, what we're calling super interglacials in the Lake Elgigikin record. So with that, I want to end by summarizing, first of all, that the Elgigikin record is offering us a glimpse for the very first time in one location. Lots of surprises. The first of all being that we have extreme warmth many, many times throughout the last few million years. And this extreme warmth has major implications probably for the stability of the Greenland ice sheet and also for the sea ice history of the Arctic. That, in fact, it may be much easier to get rid of that sea ice than we thought before.
Thank you, Julie. Any questions or comments?
So in stage 31 at 1.1 million, yes, we see dark coniferous forests come back to the lake.
But is it there now?
Because no.
Because the carbon dioxide is the same, you said, right?
No, but it's, let's say it's coming. I mean, if you look at all across the north, tree line is marching north. The shrub tundra is starting to move into the open tundra regions. Even though we're at approaching 400 parts per mil now, the Earth system has to catch up. Richard Alley has said this before that, hey, Greenland is still thinking decades ago. Greenland hasn't even caught up to where we are now. And so the transition to actually see the vegetation move will take many, many decades.
That was University of Massachusetts Amherst Professor Julie Brigham-Grett presenting results from research at Lake Elgigikin on the eastern tip of Siberia in the Russian Arctic. Search for her video on YouTube or find that link in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Now we know the world will never be the same. please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org.
Get on your bike, sit on the seat, put your feet on the pedal, and ride it all around, ride it all around. Get on your bike, sit on the seat.
Quick quiz. What way of getting around is growing faster than any mode of transport in the history of the planet? If you said cars, motorbikes, or skateboards, no. The right answer is bike sharing. It's almost enough to give us hope. Here to brighten our day with news about the wave of carbon-friendly bicycle travel around the world is Janet Larson. She's the Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute. Janet, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Well, before we get to that sharing part, is there anywhere in modern cities to use these bikes safely without being run down by cars?
Oh, certainly. I think cities around the globe are trying to figure out how to make the bicycle a more integrated part of their transportation schemes. And to do that, that means increasing bicycle lanes, increasing bicycle paths, having separated cycle tracks alongside traffic but separated by bollards or permanent cones so that cyclists can cycle in comfort and know they have a part of the road, which cyclists have always asked cars to share the road, and now cities are trying to make it even easier for them to do so.
I was always in love with a setup in Amsterdam where they have separate bike paths that aren't part of the sidewalk. They aren't part of the roads. They're like just separate little paths that run right through the city.
Exactly. Amsterdam has long been a cycling leader. Copenhagen is another city people point to where the traffic lights are timed in what they call a green wave so that at a normal cycling speed, you can go through intersection after intersection after intersection, always hitting a green light while you ride along the separated safe cycle track. So it's very exciting what a number of European cities are doing to make it easier for people to get around on two wheels. And right now in Copenhagen, over 35% of trips are made on bicycles. I think Amsterdam's even slightly higher. So it's clearly it's working.
Right. I've been to Amsterdam, and I've looked down the main streets of the city at 9:30 in the morning, for example. You hardly see a car. Everybody's using the transit, and they're using their bikes. Well, there's plenty of bike action in North America, and we will get to that. But I'd like to hear a little bit more about Copenhagen, what their plan was. And I heard that they've shut it down after 17 years. What's going to replace it? Talk to us about that, would you?
Well, Amsterdam sort of kicked off the bike-sharing universe. Back in the 60s, there was a group that left 50-some bicyclists in various parts of the city scattered around. They were painted bright white. Copenhagen took off after that, and in several Danish cities, along with Copenhagen, they had bicycles where they were placed around the city. Some were for free. Some had a system where you could put in a coin, not very much money at all, and check out a bicycle, return it to another dock. And in Copenhagen, that it's called Bicyklen, which means city bike, and they had over 1,000 bicycles on the street for 17 years, and just in the end of 2012, they shut down that program. Then there was an announcement that it would not be replaced right away because the city was having trouble getting funding, and the outroar was enormous, and so City Hall had to backpedal, and now there are planning to get a modern system on the streets this year, we hope. And when I say a modern bike sharing system, instead of a coin deposit system, it would be based probably on a smart card or smart lock technology where people can sign up with a membership, usually using a credit card, and you get your own code or your membership key, and you can use that to check in and out bicycles. And that's a way to generally cut down on the number of bikes that are stolen, disappeared, vandaled because it's associated with your membership card. So that's how Copenhagen's ready to move forward into the next generation of bike sharing.
That was a problem. I remember with those white bikes in Amsterdam, they were pretty ugly, they were pretty basic, and they worked great, but people loaded them up in trucks and sold them off in Eastern Europe. You mentioned in your release that there's also ways that they could put special parts that can't be replaced or other ways to avoid this problem of bike stealing.
Exactly. As bike sharing has evolved, it's gone from just painting bikes colors, which then could easily be repainted and sold on the black market, or they put on container ships and ending up in Africa or anywhere in the world. Now, the new ones, generally, new programs opening up have pretty distinctive looking bikes. The parts are unique to those bikes so that you can't just take your regular old tools and disassemble it and then use those parts on any other bike. So they have very little value except in the system. That's the way that most of the cities opening new programs are going now.
And what's happening with bike sharing in France?
Well, France is interesting because France does not have that same kind of long-held cycling culture that the Netherlands or Denmark has, where people just use bikes to get around day to day. In France, the car is in most of the cities is much more prevalent, but it was France that ushered the world into, we call this modern era of bike sharing. In 1998, when the advertising company Clear Channel opened the world's first public computerized bike program with 200 bikes in the city of Rennes. And then in 2005, France's third largest city, Lyon, opened a program called Vélov that had 1,500 bikes at 100 automated self-service docking stations. And Lyon's program was enormously successful. Just within the first year, the city saw bicycle ridership increase 44%. And the program was deemed to be a success about getting people out of the cars. You'd see the bikes everywhere around Lyon. And that led to the opening of possibly the world's most well-known bike sharing program, Vélib, in Paris, which opened in 2007. And Vélib has been incredibly popular among Parisians and tourists alike. Vélib opened in 2007 with 10,000 bicycles and very quickly doubled. They now have over 2,000 bikes in their fleet. And this was an innovative program. It was the city of Paris entered into a 10-year contract with the advertising firm JC Deco. JC Deco would be in charge of getting the bikes on the street and operating the program, maintaining it, in exchange for street-side advertising space so they could put up billboards for their clients around the city in exchange for running this program for the city. And since 2007, there have been over 130 million trips on the Vélib bicycles. People come back from Paris and say the bikes were everywhere. And 10 years ago, people really weren't biking around Paris that much. But now people have joined the program, realize it's possible to get to and from their workplaces or the cafe on a bicycle. And it's just really changed the culture overall. You know, still, city acknowledges there's room to grow. Bicycling had been about less than a 1% share of all trips before the Vélib opened, and now it's about 3% of all trips. So it's a great growth, but Paris realizes it can go farther. And its current mayor, Bertrand Delanoë, he is a huge champion of bicycles. In fact, he said that the automobile no longer has a place in the big city of our times. And so he's moving forward developing new bike lanes and paths. They're going to have 700 kilometers of bike lanes by the end of next year. And they've reduced speed limits in the inner part of the city, making it much more friendly for people to bike around without worrying about getting hit by a car. There's dedicated bus lanes so that buses can move around more efficiently as well. And the bike sharing system really complements that bus, the subway, the mass transit, because it solves what transportation planners call the first mile and the last mile problem. You can jump on a bike, get yourself to a bus station or a train station, ride the bus or train to your place of work or as close to it as you can get, and then you can hop on another bike if you have to travel another mile or so to get to your office. So people have had great luck doing it, and you don't have to dress yourself in spandex and lycra to do it. People are doing it in high heels with their fancy purses and scarves, and it's really revolutionized Parisian transport.
I just love hearing about this. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Janet Larson, Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the new bicycle revolution. Well, there's another aspect to this, and I'm thinking about the country of Spain. Now, they're going through tremendous economic difficulties at the time, very high unemployment, about 26%. It's over 50% for young people there. And bicycles are a much better way to get around. So in a way, if you can develop your bicycle transport system, you're also developing resiliency for difficult times and helping the people who need it the most.
That's a great point. The bike is, you know, once you have a bike, there's no gasoline to fuel it with. The operating costs are very small. Repairs are far, you know, you could buy a new bike for what a typical auto repair would cost if you needed to. And then the bike sharing system is just another way if to even get around ownership of a bicycle. Somebody else is maintaining it. Somebody else is pumping up the tires. You just pay a relatively modest annual membership fee. And then you have access. You're able to get around. So if you're job hunting, looking for a job, you can use the bike to get there. So it's great for young people who might not have a driver's license or anybody who can't afford a car. And then more generally, people who decide they don't want to be burdened by a personal automobile that they then have to figure out where to park and take care of. So the bike sharing is really great, particularly for these dense cities and then our urbanizing world as a whole.
I run into a lot of young people who tell me, there's just no way I can afford a car right now. And even if I could, I'd rather spend the money on lattes and other things, you know, or pay for the new house that I want. So they're just not buying a car. They're not getting a driver's license. And the bike is the way they're going. I think that's progress.
Oh, I think so, definitely. It used to be sort of a rite of passage. You get your car and then you go out and cruise the boulevard. And that's how you meet up with your friends. And today, you know, there's smartphones, there's the internet. That's how people are socializing. People are busy. They want to make the most of their commuting time. So if you can, you know, hop on a bike, then get to a metro system where then you can sit in the metro and read your iPhone or your iPad and then jump off and get on another bike and get where you need to go. You don't have to waste time behind the wheel. And it's freeing. It's also, it increases, I think, the well-being and the feeling of connection with the community when you're on a bike versus a car. You often are going slower, although I guess I must say in cities that are plagued by congestion, oftentimes you can get where you need to go faster in a bike than you can in a car. But you're looking around at your surroundings. I bike from my home in Northeast Washington, D.C. to my office in Northwest Washington, D.C. And when I'm stopped at a light, you know, you chat with the other cyclist next to you and say good morning. And it just really increases the social fabric of a community. It's just such a more human scale thing than to be trapped inside your car.
Out of the boxes and into the peoplescape. Janet Larson, lay some statistics on us. How many cities have bike sharing projects? How many bikes? How fast is it growing?
Well, this was something that really surprised us when we, at Earth Policy Institute, we tried to track the number of cities and countries with bike sharing programs. And it seems like every week there's new cities and programs being added, but worldwide, there's almost 49 countries now with advanced bike sharing programs, more than 500 cities, and the combined fleet is over 500,000 bicycles. It's growing faster than any other form of transportation in human history. It's really started in Europe, but now that is spreading and North America is finally getting on board, our number of programs in the United States is set to double within the next year or two.
I'm going to be asking you about specific parts of the United States, but before we get there, I want to ask, is this just a fad among richer countries? What is happening in Mexico, for example, or in Asia?
Oh, well, so start with Latin America. Mexico City opened a bike sharing program a few years ago, and when they did, they quickly had to establish a wait list because they got more membership requests than they thought the system could accommodate. Mexico City, if you've been there, you know that the traffic is just horrendous. It's hard to imagine being on a bicycle there, but the city now is working to try to have its bicycle infrastructure match the interest of in cycling. They have a famous event on Sundays in Mexico City, where a lot of the major streets are shut down to cars, and you get 15,000 or more people out on bicycles, families, young people, old people out on the cycles, enjoying the sight, enjoying the streets. So I think they're really trying to boost the culture there, and the bike share is just a part of it. In several other Latin American countries, I think there's a dozen or so programs in Latin America. Brazil has a few programs, including in Sao Paulo, where there's actually two separate companies that have established bike share. Colombia has a program. Quito, Ecuador has one. But if you want to see where bike share is really booming, you look at Asia. The biggest program in the world now is in Wuhan, China, that has a city of 9 million people, and they have 90,000 shared bikes in their bike share system. It's enormous. The second largest one is in Hangzhou, which has almost 70,000 bicycles in its scheme, and you see them everywhere. You know, China has long been known as the bicycle kingdom. It's the world's leading bicycle manufacturer and exporter. You picture Chinese cities on the bike, but in recent decades, the car had really taken over, and I think these bike-sharing schemes are the city planners and the people's way of saying, you know, wait, give us back our two wheels. Let us get around better, because they realize that in big cities like Beijing and Shanghai, people were just spending hours stuck behind the wheel in a traffic jam and not getting anywhere they needed to go. So combining some of their new bus rapid transit systems with fast-moving buses with bike sharing systems, I think, is the way to go. And China is going gangbusters.
Yeah, it makes me sad to think about what happened in China. In the early 1990s, we saw that video of throngs of commuters filling the streets, biking into work, and it had to be so healthy for the people. Now, you hardly want to breathe the air because the same polluting car culture from America and pushed by the same car companies like General Motors has kind of filled up the Chinese streets. I wonder, is that car culture beginning to fail them?
Oh, it's certainly not working. It's not working for the China, you know, that Western car-centered model. It's not going to work in the developing countries. Ultimately, it's failed us here in the West as well. Yet, when I was in Beijing a few years ago and talking to young people, they said, yes, traffic's horrible, but, you know, when I can afford it, I want to get a car. I don't feel like it's fully permeated society, but I think the recent incidences where the air pollution has been just so choking, that may be starting to change people's minds. You know, that's not just automobiles, that's also their coal-fired power plants and whatnot. But I think people have got a glimpse of what could happen when you have clear sky days after they hosted the Olympics in Beijing. And so now perhaps more people will start to try to ask for that on a day-to-day basis.
Well, as you say, they've got a history of the bike culture, and I'm hoping that they can turn it around and bring it back. It's going to be better for everybody and for the climate. Another whole aspect of this is bike messengers and inner city deliveries. We have a small fleet of tricycle freight bikes operating in downtown Vancouver. They're making small deliveries to retail stores. Did you happen to look at that?
We have looked at that, and the bike messenger culture is just amazing. I mean, in New York City, you want to deliver a document from one office to another. The bicycle is certainly the best way to do it. We also have a big fleet of them here in the U.S. In fact, one of the big bike sharing companies called B-Cycle is doing a trial with a utility trike as part of its bike sharing fleet to allow people to perhaps carry goods as well as just be a mode of personal transit. So it's not only the best way to move things around in many cities, but the bike sharing programs are realizing too, people need to, sometimes you need to haul stuff, but bikes can help you do that. In fact, some of the bike sharing programs are experimenting with movable docking stations, because one of the problems that is sort of inherent in the bike sharing world is that sometimes people will just take a bike one way, so the programs have to do some rebalancing, move bikes around. Like in Paris, they were finding people would more often bike downhill than they would bike uphill. So there does have to be some movement of the fleet back.
And you mentioned New York. Is there anything else exciting happening there for bike culture?
Yes. New York City will be rolling out in May, most likely, what will become the biggest bike sharing system in the United States. They ultimately want to get up to 10,000 bicycles citywide, if not larger. But they'll start with a smaller rollout of about just over 5,000 bikes this spring. And they opened up their registration for memberships just the other week. And within 24, 30 hours, they had 5,000 people sign up for these bikes and are not even available yet. So there's huge pent-up demand in New York City for this bike-sharing program. And over the last few years, Mayor Bloomberg has done a lot to extend New York's bike lane network as well. So it's getting much easier to ride around the city on a bicycle, and riders will soon be able to do it on these bikes. New York's system is called Citibike. It's sponsored by Citibank, and the stations are up. They had a lot of delays, in part because of technology and supply chain problems, and then Hurricane Sandy damaged some of the infrastructure. So I think cyclists in New York have been waiting and waiting and waiting, and now they'll soon be able to get on their bikes and ride them.
Well, I guess this is the big news that you bring. It's not just that bicycles are sharing the road, but that we're sharing the bikes. And I have heard through the interview several suggestions on why you would want to share one rather than just own your own. You don't have to park it at home. You don't have to protect it all the time. But why are you thinking that bike sharing is the way to go rather than private bike ownership?
Well, it's not an either-or thing. I think they work well in concert. In fact, anecdotally, talking to a lot of people I know in Washington, D.C. who have signed up for our Capital Bike Share, most of us who are members also have our own bikes, but it's just a way to add extra flexibility to your commute. It may be pouring rain in the morning, so you may take the subway or a bus to your office, but then when the sun comes out in the afternoon, you want to be able to jump on a bike and get to your softball game or happy hour, or to pick up your kid from daycare. And then you can jump on the bike and do that. And then maybe you pick up your kid, but you don't want to take your kid on the bike yet, so you jump back on a bus or the subway system. So it's just a way to have a much more flexible transit system, and that's what a lot of the bike share operators really consider themselves, their transit. So they can be just part of a network within a city. And then it really complements bike ownership. In fact, some of the bicycle retailers had been worried about what's going to happen. You open this program, how are we going to sell any bikes? But in several of the cities that have studied it, including Washington, D.C. and San Antonio, Texas, they actually found that sales of private bikes also increased after the introduction of a bike sharing system. I think in part because people tried it out. It was like a gateway drug or something. And they said, wow, this is a great way to get along. I need my own bike. Or people saw more cyclists on the road and decided, you know, they wanted to jump in and do it too. So it works really well with existing cyclists often sign up to give themselves more flexibility because your bike's not always with you when you need it. And then it gets new people into cycling as well.
Well, what are you doing with all this information and how can people find it?
On our website, earthpolicy.org, people can see our article about bike sharing around the world, complete with a big data set listing the countries and places you can find programs around the world. And that's what we have at earthpolicy.org. There's also a great resource done by Paul DeMayo and Russell Medin called the Bike Share Blog and the Bike Share World Map. And I highly recommend that people check them out because there you can see on a Google map where there's bike sharing programs all around the world, not just existing ones, but where cities are exploring them. And if your city is not yet on the Bike Share World Map, I would recommend that people who are excited about it contact their local officials and see what's being done, because I've talked to city planners in a number of cities and almost every single one is starting to look at this. And so I think they need to hear more enthusiasm that there really is an interest in bike sharing, because it's worked for large cities like Paris, but it's also working in tiny ones like Tulsa, Oklahoma, of all places, was the first modern solar-powered bike-sharing program in the United States in a tiny town. So it can work on all sorts of scales.
Our guest has been Janet Larson, the Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute. This Bicycle Update is part of a series on the positive news coming from the Institute, and it covers everything from clean energy to maybe climate-friendly diet plans. And it's called Plan B, as advanced by the Institute's founder, Lester Brown. Track it down at earthpolicy.org. Janet, I appreciate so much good news for a change.
It's great to talk about bicycling.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can find links for this program in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Please support Radio EcoShock if you can at our website, ecoshock.org, and grab lots of our free MP3 downloads of past programs. Are we out of time? Find out next week as I look into human extinction.
This is Jeff Blankford. In the dog and pony show, that was last week's Democratic convention, that's phony, not pony, there were a couple of important supporters of Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton who didn't appear on the stage nor have their names mentioned. One was Robert Kagan, co-founder of the Project of New American Century, the core neocon group that was the most prominent sponsor of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and whom you've heard me mention a number of times in this program. The second was Israeli-American multi-billionaire media mogul Haim Saban, the largest donor to Clinton's war chest, who has already provided in the neighborhood of $10 million to her campaign, and who said back in 2008 he would spend whatever would be necessary to get her elected. Saban says he finds her combination of being liberal on domestic issues and hawkish on foreign affairs appealing. Hillary, in return, has declared herself to be one of Haim's Power Rangers, a reference to the teenagers with superhuman capabilities whose efforts on kids' Saturday morning TV made Saban his first millions. On his part, Robert Kagan has made no secret of his feelings for Clinton, since she picked him as an advisor to her State Department and chose his wife, Victoria Nuland, who had served as a top aide to Vice President Dick Cheney, to be the State Department's chief spokesperson. In September of 2013, 8 months after Clinton left the State Department, President Obama appointed Nuland Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. From that position, which she helped orchestrate the provocative, quote, regime change in Ukraine in 2014 and select its new prime minister. Later that year, Kagan told the New York Times that he hoped that his neocon views, which he had begun to call, quote, liberal interventionist, would prevail should Clinton reach the White House. There was already speculation that Nuland would become Clinton's Secretary of State. The New York Times noted that Clinton, quote, remains the vessel into which many interventionists are pouring their hopes, end quote, and quoted Kagan as saying, quote, I feel comfortable with her on foreign policy. If she pursues a policy, which we think she will pursue, it's something that might have been called neocon. But clearly her supporters are not going to call it that. They're going to call it something else, end quote, Robert Kagan. What will be on Clinton's foreign policy agenda did not get much attention during last week's convention, though what we did hear was, in a word, frightening. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be discussing that agenda with James W. Carden, a contributing writer for The Nation who previously served as an advisor on Russia to the Special Representative for Global Intergovernmental Affairs at the State Department. A moment ago, I used the word frightening, and not only to describe the speech on the last day of the convention by retired Marine General John Allen, but also the response of the attendees supporting Clinton, some of whom may have been paid to be there, who kept hollering, USA, USA, to drown out the supporters of Bernie Sanders, who were shouting, no more war, no more war, as Allen was speaking, or more accurately, frothing at the mouth. On top of that, the Democratic National Committee, the very same that had done whatever it could to sidetrack the Sanders campaign throughout the primary season, passed out posters emblazoned with a red, white, and blue USA in capital letters to wave while they were screaming it out during General Allen's short presentation. It would have brought smiles to the face of Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan, as I suspect, with the words that General Allen, Clinton's choice, shouted into the microphone. For those of you who had better things to do at the time when he was speaking, and for those who might have heard it and watched it, it bears listening to again, because what he represents needs to be etched into our consciousness as we prepare for what follows the November election. So here it is, with just a couple of minutes tuned out.
Americans, I stand with you tonight, a retired 4-star general of the United States Marine Corps. And I am joined by my fellow generals and admirals, and with these magnificent young veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. They are here before you because this most consequential election is the greatest one in our memory for the President of the United States. The stakes are enormous. We must not, and we could not, stand on the sidelines.
USA!
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 USA! My fellow Americans, from the battlefield to the capitals of our allies and friends and partners, the free people of the world look to America as the last best hope for peace and liberty for all humankind. For we are the greatest country on this planet. So we stand before you tonight to endorse Hillary Clinton for the President of the United States of America. We trust in her judgment. We trust in her judgment. We believe in her vision for a united America. We believe in her vision of an America as a just and strong leader against the forces of hatred, the forces of chaos and darkness. We know that she, as no other, knows how to use all instruments of American power, not just the military, to keep us all safe and free. My fellow Americans, I tell you, without hesitation or reservation, that Hillary Clinton will be exactly the kind of commander-in-chief America needs. I know this. I know this because I served with her. I know this as the former special presidential envoy to the global coalition to counter ISIS. With her as our commander-in-chief, America will continue to lead this volatile world. We will oppose and resist tyranny, and we will defeat evil. America will defeat ISIS and protect the homeland. America will honor our treaty obligations. We will lead and strengthen NATO and the Atlantic Alliance and our allies in East Asia and around the world, whom we have sworn a solemn oath to defend. My fellow Americans, we will stop the spread of nuclear weapons and keep them from the hands of dangerous states and groups. Our armed forces will be stronger. They will have the finest weapons, the greatest equipment. They will have the support of the American people. You and the American military will continue to be the shining example of America at our very best. Our veterans will be thanked by a grateful nation. And they will be cared for in the manner they deserve, for the sacrifices they have made for all of us, for this great country and for world peace. With Hillary Clinton as our commander-in-chief, the United States will continue to be that indispensable, transformational power in the world. To our allies and to our friends and partners, listen closely. We are with you. America will not abandon you. To those acting against peace, acting against civilization and the world order, we will oppose you. And to our enemies, we will pursue you as only America can. You will fear us, and to ISIS and others, we will defeat you.
General, retired Marine General John Allen, the man that Hillary Clinton chose to burnish her warrior credentials. It was all too much for Canadian-American actress Margot Kidder. Still in a rage, on the very next day, on the Counterpunch website, Kidder wrote, quote, "The anti-Americanism in me is about to explode and land God knows where as my rage is well beyond reason. And I, by heritage, half American in a way that makes me more, quote, American than almost anyone else in this country, except for the true Americans, the American Indians, am in utter denial tonight that I am, as you are, American as well. I am half Canadian," she wrote. "I was brought up there with very different values than you Americans hold, and tonight, after the endless spit-ups and boasts and rants about the greatness of American militarism and praise for American military strength and boasts about wiping out ISIS and America being the strongest country on earth, and an utterly inane story from a woman whose son died in Obama's war about how she got to cry in gratitude on Obama's shoulder, tonight I feel deeply Canadian. Every subtle lesson I was ever subliminally given about the bullies across the border and their rudeness and their lack of education and their self-given right to bomb whoever they wanted in the world for no reason other than that they wanted something that people in the other country had, and their greed came oozing to the surface of my psyche." Kidder tried to get it out of her head by taking a walk along the Yellowstone River in Montana where she lives, but she wrote, quote, "It just couldn't touch the rage in my heart. The visions of all the dead children in Syria that Hillary Clinton helped to kill, the children bombed to bits in Afghanistan and Pakistan from Obama's drones, the grisly chaos of Libya, the utter wasteland of Iraq, the death and destruction everywhere caused by American military intervention, Ukraine, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, Chile, you name it. Your country has bombed it or destroyed its civilian life in some basic way. I knew in my gut," she went on, "that what I was taught as a child was true, which is that you are the enemy. You are the country to be feared. You are the country to be disgusted by. You are ignorant, and your greed and self-satisfaction and unearned pride knows no bounds. I am not an American tonight," Kidder concluded. "I reject my Puritan ancestors who landed in this country in 1648. I reject the words I voiced in my citizenship ceremony. I reject every moment of thrilling discovery I ever had in this country," end quote. Those were the words of Canadian-born actress Margot Kidder in response to the warmongering speech of General Allen, John Allen, who you just heard, on how U.S. militarism and greatness were celebrated at the Democratic National Convention. Her entire article, from which the previous lines were excerpted, can be found on counterpunch.org online. Following the release by WikiLeaks of emails from the Democratic National Committee that confirmed, as Bernie Sanders and his supporters had claimed, that the DNC was working for Clinton and against him, Committee Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz quickly resigned. It was then reported that she would open the convention and step aside, but she'd become such an embarrassment for the Clinton forces that even that brief appearance was canceled, and yesterday two more high-level staff from the DNC were forced to step down. But lest anyone think that Mrs. Clinton and her advisors were about to change their ways when it came to dealing with Sanders supporters, the announcement that Clinton had made Wasserman Schultz the honorary chair of her campaign immediately dispelled that. There were numerous reports on Real News Network, Democracy Now!, and social media of how Sanders' delegates and backers were abused by the DNC thugs who stripped away posters for Sanders and for Palestinian rights against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, which Clinton is expected to once again endorse, and signs opposing war. There were also Sanders supporters who had paid their way to Philadelphia and had tickets for the convention but were not allowed in. It was not much different in effect from a Trump campaign rally, although there were no reports that I'm aware of that anyone was punched. For me, the most telling story in this regard was the refusal of the DNC to allow former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner, who had nominated Barack Obama in 2008, to do the same for Sanders when it came time to announce the Ohio delegate vote. Because she had been speaking at a protest outside of the convention area, Turner, an African-American woman who first endorsed Clinton before becoming one of Sanders' most important speaking surrogates, was not allowed back in, despite having the proper credentials. Sanders protesters stormed the media tents to express their outrage that Turner had been denied a spot on the debate stage. That Sanders himself did not stand up to the DNC's overseers and demand that Nina Turner be permitted to rejoin the Ohio delegation and speak was not, to put it in the most delicate terms, his finest hour. According to a detailed article in Politico, after difficult negotiations, Sanders had made his deal with Clinton and her team. In exchange for a primetime speaking slot, Sanders agreed to endorse his opponent and that he and his campaign staff would make a sincere effort to mollify his supporters, which didn't go down well, particularly with the California, Oregon, and Colorado delegations that walked out. On Tuesday, the Clinton campaign needed to make sure protesters wouldn't disrupt the historic roll call that would officially make Clinton the first woman to be nominated to the top of a major party's ticket. According to Politico, the campaign blasted out an email to its delegates urging them to take the train to the Wells Fargo Center and pack the arena by 2 p.m. Meanwhile, as the story unfolded, Robbie Mook and Charlie Baker from Clinton's team sat down with Jeff Weaver and other Sanders operatives. They were eager to find a way for Sanders to play peacemaker, and Sanders seemed willing. He agreed to offer an acclamation speech, taking the mic during roll call to ask that the rules be suspended and that Clinton be named nominee. But he wanted to do it on the main stage. Clinton's campaign said no. He had been given his due on Monday, and Tuesday was meant to mark a pivot to Clinton and her record. Sanders didn't push it, according to the Politico article. Indeed, Clinton's aides said he, quote, did everything we asked of him. Sanders' fear of a Trump presidency, I believe, was truly genuine. Trump was the predictable end product of 2 decades of Fox News and countless right-wing AM talk radio shows, a foul pile of excrement. But whether he is a greater danger to the country and to the planet than Clinton is an open question. Clinton promises enduring war, perhaps even a nuclear showdown with Russia, and interventions everywhere, while at home offering the public another term of Obama and safe Supreme Court nominees. Trump, on the other hand, will try to do business with America's declared enemies rather than bombing them, while provoking unprecedented as well as unpredictable racial conflict here at home. Never have the Democrats and Republicans offered the American people such horrible choices. If nothing changes between now and November, expect the Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson and the Green Party's choice Jill Stein to attract record vote. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chuck Collins, author and a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the opportunities for progress on reversing income inequality, a major issue in this year's presidential election campaign. Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who examines the growing skepticism surrounding the impeachment of Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff. And Claire Miller of the Toxics Action Center, who explains why a coalition of environmental groups are calling for a halt to the nation's conversion to natural gas and move instead to a true clean energy economy. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Australians were outraged over the image of a hooded 17-year-old Aboriginal detainee, Dylan Voller, strapped into a metal chair during the Australian Broadcasting Company's Four Corners TV program. The video of the juvenile prisoner brought back haunting memories of the torture of prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, Iraq, and detainees held at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp in Cuba. Australia's Conservative Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull called for an inquiry into youth detention facilities in the Northern Territory, the location of the Don Dale Youth Detention Centre in Darwin, where Voller was held. In the province, nearly all youth detainees are Aboriginals. The use of a chair restraint is very controversial in Australia, but the local government has expanded its use. A 2015 report by the Territory's Children's Commissioner criticised the behaviour of guards at the Don Dale Detention Centre, where video of Voller and other Aboriginal boys was shot in 2014 and 2015. Amnesty International observed that the images of a hooded detainee recalls the horror of Guantanamo Bay and constitute a shocking violation of both the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child and the Convention Against Torture. America's opioid addiction epidemic became the focus of corporate media coverage during the early days of the 2016 presidential campaign. Now, President Obama has pledged $1 billion for treatment, and Republicans are discussing the damage done to lives from opioid abuse. Yet, with little attention and no opposition, legislation passed Congress and was signed into law by President Obama that will make it more difficult to take action against opioid manufacturers. The new law allows pharmaceutical companies who fail to report sales of these drugs to black marketeers to submit a corrective action plan, avoiding stiff penalties from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. The bill had the full backing of the U.S. pharmaceutical industry. According to the Los Angeles Times, the legislation and the clout of Big Pharma on Capitol Hill prompted Joseph Ranazzisi to resign his post as Deputy Assistant Administrator at the DEA last fall. The former DEA official observed, "There's thousands of people dying from opioid overdoses, and this bill is going to provide protection to people we are investigating." Nearly 200,000 people have died from overdoses of opioid drugs across the U.S. since 1999. In 2012, Barack Obama captured 73% of the Asian American vote to win re-election. The surge of support for the Democratic candidate was only exceeded by the enthusiasm of African-American voters for Obama that year. Yet, 20 years earlier, Republican President H.W. Bush won a strong majority of the Asian-American vote in what was then viewed as a culturally conservative community. Asians who began immigrating to the United States in the mid-1800s have a history of keeping their distance from electoral politics, especially after the World War II unconstitutional internment of Japanese Americans. Yet, many Asian American voters supported Republicans, including the first President Bush, during the post-Vietnam Cold War era. According to the American Prospect magazine, during the 1990s, President Bill Clinton reached out to the Asian American community, which began an historic shift that rivals the switch of political loyalties among African Americans from Republicans to Democrats during the New Deal era of the 1930s. The power of the Christian right inside the GOP and Donald Trump's angry anti-Muslim rhetoric has alienated many Asians from supporting the Republican Party. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Thanks in part to the economic agenda of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders during his unsuccessful Democratic Party primary campaign and the Occupy Wall Street movement that emerged in 2011, the issue of income and wealth inequality has become a topic of serious debate in this year's presidential election campaign. Workers fighting for a rise in the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour across the U.S. have also highlighted growing frustration and anger about the growing gap between the nation's rich and poor. According to a new analysis by economist Emmanuel Saez, Americans in the bottom 99% of the country's income distribution saw their take-home pay rise 3.9% in 2015 over 2014's levels, adjusted for inflation, the highest increase in 17 years. But the top 1% wealthiest Americans' income grew by 7.7% last year, giving us the highest levels of income inequality in U.S. history. Your reporter spoke with Chuck Collins, an author and director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and an activist with the group Patriotic Millionaires. Here he discusses the opportunities for progressive change on the issue of income and wealth inequality in this year's presidential election campaign.
Well, I definitely agree that there's an awakening, that more and more people are drawing connections between their own economic circumstances and these larger economic trends. I think coming out of the economic meltdown, we sort of started to break the taboos around talking about class and inequality. And I think part of that is that, you know, we have a very high tolerance for inequality in the United States, as long as we feel the system is working for the rules are fair and that anybody can work hard and have the opportunity to get ahead. And I think what's happening is more people are realizing that the rules are rigged and that social mobility is declining, that people are working extremely hard, but they're stuck in first gear or they're slipping backwards. And I think that's people's real life experience. And then I think, yeah, when you have somebody like Bernie Sanders get up and say, this isn't just your individual problem, this is a societal problem, it's a systemic problem, I think it lifts that issue up. But I even think Donald Trump's campaign is, in a way, speaking to the same problem, which is a growing number of people who feel like they are just slipping backwards, whether it's because of global trade or whatever explanation they have. It's the same symptoms, if you will.
Chuck, I wanted to ask you about the vehicles for change in terms of reversing inequality. Tax policy is huge. If you had the ear of a president or powerful politicians in Congress and could recommend changes to our tax code or tax policy overall, what would be the most important things that you would recommend?
I guess I would reverse some of the tax cuts for the wealthy that we've put in place over the last couple decades. So I would raise the top income tax rates on, you know, incomes over $1 million up. I would make the inheritance tax, or what we call the estate tax, more progressive, meaning estates over $1 billion, I would have pay at a much higher rate than estates over $10 million, which is where it starts. I would put in place a financial transaction tax. It slows some of the speculative activity on Wall Street, but it also raises substantial money. If I could link some of those revenue raisers to things that actually would make a huge difference in people's lives. So I think a debt-free college education fund, certainly at public and state universities, could be easily funded by a financial transaction tax or a more robust tax on wealth and inheritances. Those are the kinds of things that we did after World War II. 1947 to 1977, we taxed the wealthy at higher rates, and we invested in things that helped broaden opportunity, home ownership, debt-free education, infrastructure investments that employed people. Those are the kind of things that I think we should do again.
Well, Chuck, what about tax avoidance? We have hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, going into offshore tax havens from wealthy folks here in the United States and all across the world. But when it comes to the United States, what could be done to prevent all these tax revenues that could support infrastructure and education and these other investment programs?
What could be done to stem the flow of dollars outside the U.S. and the tax revenue that goes with it?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things. There's, as you mentioned, Scott, the offshore system that the Panama Papers and others have revealed. And then there's the huge kind of loophole industry, both that individuals and corporations use to reduce their taxes. Those are actually things that can be fixed if there's a political will. There are certain trust mechanisms that are just set up entirely for the purpose of tax dodging, and those could just be ruled illegal. Some of the international stuff would have to be done in concert with other countries. We would need treaties to expand transparency of both corporate tax reporting and individuals' ability to hide their wealth around the world. But the United States has huge power in that equation. If the United States took the lead, other countries would certainly follow. So it's really a question of political will. You and I and our listeners just need to say it's, you know, it's not okay that there's this huge sort of shadow tax system that allows global corporations and very wealthy people to sort of opt out of their responsibilities to paying taxes. But it's totally fixable.
If you were an advisor to some of these very passionate Bernie Sanders supporters who have a mind to continue their political activism in the coming year, hopefully after the election is over in November, what would you have them focus on in terms of economic inequality? What kind of political agitation do you feel would be useful and an efficient use of their time?
I guess my encouragement would be to remember that it's not really about the candidates. It really is about all of us organizing, making our voices heard, maybe even running for office. I would encourage people not to be discouraged, to understand we put huge pressure on the political system and on the platform and have changed the conversation. And to keep that work going, basically have to keep doing it at all different levels.
That was Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Collins, also an activist with the group Patriotic Millionaires, is the author of the forthcoming book, Born on Third Base. Learn more about the fight to reverse growing income inequality by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Brazil prepares for the opening of the 2016 Summer Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, U.S. corporate media has focused much of its attention on the threat posed by the mosquito-transmitted Zika virus and the health hazards athletes will be exposed to from untreated sewage flowing into waterways where sailing and swimming competitions will be held. But most Brazilians are focused on their nation's political crisis, where President Dilma Rousseff, who was suspended from office in May, will soon be put on trial in the Senate on charges of breaking budgetary rules. If convicted, she will be removed from office. While there's very little attention paid to Brazil's impeachment process in the U.S., 40 Democratic members of the U.S. House of Representatives published an open letter directed at U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry on July 25th, expressing their deep concern about threats to democracy in Brazil. The letter, which was written with support from the AFL-CIO, stated that the impeachment process has come under fire for procedural irregularities, corruption, and political motivations. The letter went on to urge the Obama administration to express concern about the threat to democratic institutions unfolding in Brazil, one of Washington's most important political and economic allies in Latin America. Underscoring the growing skepticism surrounding the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, a Brazilian federal prosecutor recently asserted that the charges of budget accounting maneuvers that triggered the impeachment process are not a crime or an impeachable offense. Your reporter spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who examines the mounting criticism of Brazil's impeachment of President Rousseff.
Well, I think the most important recent development, which just happened last week, is the 43 members of Congress, Democrats, signed a letter to John Kerry saying that the United States should not support this impeachment process. Now, that's really big, you know, and it's interesting. This shows you the problem of the media in the United States. Only one news outlet, major news outlet, even sizable news outlet in the U.S., reported on it, and that was the Los Angeles Times. And I think that's because they have a particularly good reporter in Brazil, but nobody else touched it. Now, this is very rare. You know, we've seen a lot of letters on Honduras, for example, to the Secretary of State. But, you know, Brazil is a huge country, population of more than 200 million, and bigger landmass than continental United States. And you don't see Democrats, dozens of Democratic members of Congress doing, I've never seen it actually, pushing back against their own Democratic administration and president on policy towards a country like Brazil. It's very rare. And I think one of the reasons it happened is because most people who are looking at this know that the U.S. kind of supports the impeachment. In fact, I wrote this today, but I can't reveal the source, but he was a member of Congress on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He said, yeah, it was very clear to him that the Obama administration is in favor of this coup. Now, who knows what they're doing to help it along? They officially have a position of neutrality, which is bad enough, but there is evidence that they did support the coup. I think I mentioned this before on this program, that a couple days after the coup, one of the leaders of the coup in the Brazilian Senate, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Aloysio Nunes, came to the U.S. and met with the number three person in the U.S. State Department, Tom Shannon, who was also a former Brazilian ambassador and is certainly the one in charge of deciding what U.S. policy should be. So just by meeting with him right after the impeachment vote in Brazil, he was sending a signal, kind of a dog whistle diplomacy, to everyone in Brazil that they really did have the back of the people who are carrying out this coup.
And I've read that a federal prosecutor in Brazil says President Dilma Rousseff's budget accounting maneuvers that triggered the impeachment process are not a crime and do not represent an abuse of power, which is one of the things that would have to have happened for the impeachment process to go forward. Now, from what I understand, the interim president, Temer, basically denies that this federal prosecutor has any legal power to derail the impeachment process.
Well, technically that's true. The Senate can do whatever it wants, just like here the House of Representatives did impeach Bill Clinton. And the Senate could have voted to convict him no matter what the charges were and whether they were an impeachable offense or anything. So, yeah, they're saying we're going to go ahead anyway. But it could be a tight vote. We don't really know. They need a two-thirds majority of 81 senators, so they need 54. And the other side, to block the impeachment, would need 28. There is a group called the G36 there, of 36 senators who said they won't vote for the impeachment, but some of them made that conditional on Dilma agreeing to a referendum on whether to hold new presidential elections, and Dilma did agree to that. So if they can reach an agreement on a referendum, then she would stay. And if you can move, you know, just a couple of senators, actually, in that direction, she would stay. But a lot of people in Brazil, you know, a lot of experts think that that's pretty tough because it's so corrupt. The whole system and the Congress is so completely corrupt that they're just assuming that they will buy the votes that they need.
Yep. I've read that the MST, Brazil's landless workers movement, has threatened to shut down the country if Dilma Rousseff is not returned to power and you know, this impeachment process is not upended. That could be a potential real flashpoint for the nation of Brazil as you get into these Olympic Games here.
Well, there is. That's right. There is a lot of resistance. There's millions of people who still support the Workers' Party and they're against the impeachment. And yeah, there will be protests, and there will be a lot of eyes on the country during the Olympics. So right now, Brazil is being ignored by most of the media, except for the Olympics. I mean, it is kind of amazing, too, when you think of the coverage that's given to political events in other South American countries. And here is Brazil, the biggest, most important of them, and they have a government that's questionable legitimacy for the first time since the military dictatorship, which, you know, isn't that long ago, you know. It ended just over 30 years ago.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose new book is titled Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. Find more analysis of Brazil's political crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A new report that evaluated several recent research papers shows definitively that natural gas is not a bridge to a clean energy future. The report was released by Toxics Action Center, the Frontier Group, Environment America, and more than a dozen community groups across New England at a press conference held in Bridgeport, Connecticut in late July. Bridgeport is the current site of Connecticut's last remaining coal-fired power plant, which is slated to be converted to use natural gas as an energy source. Bridgeport's coal plant, that produces electricity for the region, not only contributes to climate change, but also pollutes the air, with harmful effects on the health of the low-income, mostly Black and Latino community in its midst. The report titled Natural Gas and Global Warming shows that older claims that gas has a modest impact on the climate are wrong, as they fail to account for the greenhouse gas effect of methane and high rates of methane leaks from gas infrastructure. The Coalition of New England Environmental Groups are calling for a halt to the region's gas infrastructure build-out and a quick conversion to a true clean energy economy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Claire Miller, lead community organizer with Toxics Action Center, who talks about the report and the energy future this coalition of environmental groups are working for.
We're seeing the older fleet of old coal-fired power plants, old nuclear power plants phase out. And in that wake of opportunity, the gas industry is really hoping to bring on a whole new wave, a new generation of gas-fired power plants, pipelines, compressor stations, LNG tanks. You know, we're still kind of feeling the ripples of the fracking boom.
How has the energy situation changed over the past decade, and how do big fossil fuel plants fit into it?
That's the way that we're used to making electricity, is by big, large power plants. That's the way that we've run our grid since we electrified, you know, back in like the 20s and 30s. And the grid of the future is different. It's thousands of solar panels scattered across roofs and on top of landfills. It's offshore wind 30 miles out into federal waters. It's a fundamentally different vision. So, you know, there's this kind of like moment where we are either going to go down this road and build a whole other generation of fossil fuels that will set us way back, or we actually have to kind of take that leap and begin really building the grid of the future.
Claire Miller, a lot of gas projects that people are opposing, pipelines, power plants, and more, are well on their way to construction. So do you think it's too late to stop them?
That is a really interesting question. I feel hesitant to say that it's ever too late. I was chatting with one of the community leaders from Oxford earlier this month, and there's some scandal around the investors, you know, some of the financials around the plant out there. So who knows? It's got all of its permits, to my knowledge, but that definitely doesn't mean that it's a done deal. And the same can be said for Bridgeport. You know, a lot of things can happen. There's a lot of moving parts and policy happening in different parts of the region right now.
The evidence is mounting that so-called natural gas is not the bridge to the clean energy future.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I want to say 10 years ago, most of the environmental community also thought that gas was going to be the bridge fuel, that it was going to, you know, ease our way into adopting a fundamentally different type of grid that's more decentralized, where people get their power from the solar panels in their neighborhood. And so it's not necessarily, you know, I don't blame people for still kind of thinking in that paradigm, but the evidence, the report that we released, which was a review of all of the different studies that have looked into this, is that it's all a wash when the fact is the gas leaks. everywhere. When you're drilling it out of the ground, some of it leaks out. When you put it from the wellhead into the truck, some of it leaks out. When you put it from the truck into the pipe, some of it leaks out. You know, it's just every step of the way, there's fugitive emissions, and it just, because methane is so much more potent than carbon, it's just a complete wash. And, any of those benefits, you know, as far as global warming mitigation, are just totally lost. So my recommendation to all of us in New England is to grapple with that as hard and as fast as we can. We already get nearly 50% of our electricity from gas, which is a lot of eggs to have in one basket. And we do not want to continue to be dependent on such a volatile fuel source where the prices are going up and down. It's too risky for our economy and for our climate. You know, let's go as fast as we can. The trends are really interesting. So in the year 2000, New England was getting 15% of its electricity from gas. And in the year 2015, we're getting 49%. For nuclear power, it's almost the same. We've gone from 31% to 30%. The things that are decreasing are coal and oil. From 2000 to 2015, coal went from 18% of the pie to 4% of the pie. That's great. And from 2000 to 2015, oil went from 22% to 2%. Also awesome. So we've seen this really great decrease in a fossil fuel, but the unfortunate thing is that it's ultimately been almost entirely replaced by another fossil fuel, which ultimately is not getting us any gains for global warming. It's definitely better for our air quality. I don't want to brush over that, but we also have this big elephant in the room called global warming.
That was Claire Miller, lead community organizer with New England's Toxics Action Center. For more information and a link to the group's energy report, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Black August has many markers throughout the long history of resistance in the Americas. There are more than we could ever recount here, but here are a few that are important and undeniable events that affected other events and indeed had global impact. It was a hot, humid morning in August 1619 when dark-skinned Africans were unloaded from a ship in the English colony of Jamestown in Virginia. They were called indentured servants by the people who purchased their contracts. It is unknown what the Dutch sailors called them. Some 30 years later, they would be called something that millions of other Africans would be called on American shores for the next 200 years, slaves. They were, in fact, captives, chained, stolen captives of a vicious race war against black life by the merchant princes of Europe. For those people who call themselves African Americans, their unique history begins here. On August 21st, 1831, the explosive rebellion of Nat Turner turned Southern society inside out. Although he has been labeled by traditional, that is, white historians, as a madman, Turner was in fact a deeply religious man who was moved by signs and portents that he saw in the summer sky, compelling him to fight for the freedom of his captive people. Only in a slavocracy would the idea of freedom fighting and resistance seem mad. Some 30 years after Nat Turner's rebellion, the Civil War would deal a death blow to American bondage. August 30th, 1856. When the name of John Brown is evoked, the shadow of Harper's Ferry arises in the mind of the small group of rebels who tried unsuccessfully to seize an American armory and foment rebellion among the slaves. But years before Harper's Ferry, John Brown had waged war against pro-slavery forces in Osawatomie, Kansas, after Missourians had sacked the town of Lawrence, Kansas, some 3 months earlier. The fighting in Kansas led to excited reports about bleeding Kansas. What they were tough, nasty border wars between anti- and pro-slavery forces, each trying to dominate the other. Indeed, Brown was called Osawatomie Brown before Harper's Ferry marked him as a martyr for the sacred cause of freedom. August 11th to 16th, 1965. The fires of Watts, a black community in Los Angeles, California, were markers for rebellion for the generation of blacks in the 1960s. These rebellions, staged in response to brutal police attacks on people, cost the lives of 34 people and also almost $20 million worth of property damaged or destroyed. August 8, 1978, one of the earlier MOVE confrontations. Some 9 MOVE men and women were sent to prison for hundreds of years, stemming from a deeply flawed trial. MOVE members continue to fight for the release of their imprisoned comrades. MOVE veterans of the August 8th police assault have been in prison for 25 years in dungeons throughout Pennsylvania. They remain rebellious spirits who oppose a repressive status quo. The spirit of Black August moves through centuries of black, Indian, and multicultural resistance. It is an emblem of the spirit of freedom. It is a long smoldering spark of the fire in the hearts of a people, hearts burning and yearning for freedom. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio. Have turned their hungry lenses to new spectacles. If there is one remaining after image, it is the one that would
seem to be the one least expected. It is the visage of two Pakistani-American Muslim parents, Kazir and Ghazala Khan, standing up for their deceased son, Captain Humayun Khan, killed in the Iraq War. If not for the boorish responses of Donald Trump, they would have passed across the national stage and been quickly forgotten. But Trump, being Trump, has made them into media stars, and by so doing has cast an unfavorable light upon himself and his candidacy. The Khan struck a heart-rending pose. Two grieving parents, husband and wife, eyes moist with the fatal memory of a beloved son lost in the carnage of Iraq. Instead of attacking the makers and enablers of the war, former President George W. Bush and then-Senator Hillary Clinton, Trump spat on the parents by hinting darkly that they were part of an anti-Trump conspiracy. They had been whipping him for a week. Trump, driven by the whips of ego, lashes out again and again and again, wounding only himself. Who would have thought that the real stars of the Clinton show wouldn't be a Clinton, but the Khan family? They have Donald Trump to thank for that. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Democratic hopes are fulfilled. Hillary Rodham Clinton will shortly become the 45th president of the United States, the first of the female gender to do so. While that is indeed remarkable, it should be noted that the majority of America's population is female, which shows us just how undemocratic the U.S. political system really is. The brilliant wife of America's second president, Abigail Adams, wife of John, implored him to, in her words, remember the ladies. He, like most husbands, ignored her, and almost two centuries would pass before women got the vote. But the world has had its share of female leaders, and striving to outrun their male counterparts, many a woman leader has unleashed the dogs of war, from Cleopatra of Ptolemaic Egypt to queens of England. In the modern era, Golda Meir of Israel, Indira Gandhi of India, and Margaret Thatcher of Britain played the bloody game once regarded as the sport of kings. Meir waged war against Arabs. Thatcher unleashed her troops against Argentina over the Falkland Malvinas Isles. And Gandhi ordered an internal war against the Sikhs, shattering their holiest shrine, the Golden Temple of Amritsar. Females in positions of power must assume a hyper-masculine, muscular, martial stance. They do this to prove they are, after all, one of the boys. And Hillary Rodham Clinton is truly just one of the boys. While a senator, she voted for the Iraq War, regarded by most foreign policy experts as the nation's worst foreign blunder. She prevailed as Secretary of State to destabilized Libya, and sent arms to anti-Gaddafi Islamists. Libya today is a smoldering charnel house. Neoliberals like her are so martial, so military-centered, that her primary opponent, the manic Donald Trump, a Republican, calls her, I kid you not, a warmonger. Worse still, he's right. As Hillary Clinton ascends to the imperial throne, it is her decision-making, not her gender, that is in question. Women once ruled the world. They may do so again. Let them rule with wisdom, compassion, and mercy, and not in pantsuits, clamoring with a game of death to just be one of the boys. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabe and the homeland of the Métis peoples. We are heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm, and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. During the summer months, we will be presenting special programming. This week, at the close of the Democratic National Convention, we provide opinions and perspectives from those trying to get the ear of Democrats and the wider U.S. public. Over the course of the next hour, we present the 2016 Democratic National Convention, Voices from the Streets of Philadelphia.
I was bruised and battered, I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. Saw my reflection in the window, didn't know my own face. Oh, brother, you're gonna leave me wasting away. Streets of Philadelphia.
Philadelphia has played host to a major political party's quadrennial convention aimed at nominating a candidate for president. The last time was the Republican National Convention, which selected George W. Bush in 2000. This time it was the Democratic Party's turn. The contest on the Democratic side has proven to be historic in some sense, by virtue of its two major mismatched contenders. It was in the Wells Fargo Center in South Philadelphia where the drama approached its climax under an international spotlight. What happened at the convention center stage is amply documented elsewhere. The purpose of this program is to profile the passionate voices on the outside, various groups, individuals, and constituencies determined to send a message to the gathering politicos as they gathered to formulate a strategy for governing the country. I had arrived in the city a couple of days before the convention officially started in the hope of catching those voices and the stories bound to be left out of mainstream media discourse. I started Saturday within the city's Broad Street subway line.
I'd love to welcome the Democratic National Convention to Philadelphia.
Henry McDonough, I'm from Maryland originally. I've lived in South Philly for 10 years, and it's the best city in the world.
Okay. So I know that there's a big Democratic National Convention in town.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that?
I don't like the Democrats, I don't like the Republicans, and I think our whole political system needs a overhaul.
Anything else you'd like to share about Philadelphia?
It's a great city, but you might still get beat up.
Thanks a lot.
No problem.
My name is Sterling, Terrace Sterling. I've been in Philly since 78, I think. I've had some trouble, in areas such as, you might say, ghetto areas. crime is still high and different things. But with prayer and unity, working together, we overcome a lot.
Across the United States right now, there's a lot of concern about you know, black people being particularly unsafe. Is that something that you've witnessed in Philadelphia?
I don't have that problem. You know, all the guys, black guys on the corner are not bad. Look at me, I'm going to preach the gospel. Okay, all the police are not bad. Look at me, talking to the kid. It's all love. So you can't judge and stereotype and be prejudiced. And you can't hate and you can't blow things up to the point where you want to make matters worse by hating.
So what do you think about, there's this big Democratic National Convention in town over the next few days. How is that impacting on you?
Well, I'm a voter. We just hope that someone gets in office that cares about everyone.
My name is Lydia Avila, and I am the executive director of the PowerShift Network, which is the organization that is hosting PowerShift 2016. PowerShift 2016 is a conference and training ground for young climate activists and leaders. We target and typically bring out young folks under 30. Our main constituency is 18 to 25, college-age students typically. And these are all folks that are typically very much interested in climate justice and environmental work, but are looking for ways to make a difference in their community, on their campus. And so this PowerShift 2016 serves as a space for them to become educated on and trained on the kinds of skills in like organizing and activism and advocacy that allows them to make an impact in their community. The young people being here in Philadelphia in the eve of this national convention is more so a sign that young people care about climate change and that it's not by any means at the bottom of our list in terms of our interest areas. A USA Today poll that they did with Rock the Vote, climate change and clean energy expansion was on the top three of the issues that millennials care about. And it seems like all of our candidates seem to forget about that. And so we wanted to remind them that not only do we care about this issue, but we want to encourage them all and push them all to do more. At 18 years old, if you have the opportunity to talk to a young person about how they can make a difference and how they can help change society, that can be really powerful. And that can be, like I said, through organizer trainings, like what we're offering this weekend, but it can also be through, the importance of getting your friends to vote. And that's also something that we're digging into this weekend, of course. So,
my name is Lindsay Petros, and I'm here on behalf of NextGen Climate. NextGen Climate Pennsylvania. NextGen Climate Pennsylvania is looking to turn out voters to support climate action candidates. So we're looking for candidates that pledge to support 50% renewable energy by 2030 and 100% renewable energy by 2050. So we are not endorsing a candidate, but really focusing on reaching out to particularly the student population and the other youth population and registering them to vote and engaging them in the upcoming election.
There was a poll a couple weeks ago, a Quinnipiac poll, that had Trump leading Hillary Clinton. But that poll was done by mostly people over the age of 35, which showed us that the millennial vote is going to be very, very important for this election. So, again, as Lindsay said, you know, our primary goal is to get out the vote for millennial voters, 35 and under, and making sure that they make their voices heard here in Pennsylvania, so that there's no excuses in November.
So my name is Paige Atchison, and this is the Put a Price on It campaign. So our goal is to put a price on carbon. The way that we're doing it is mobilizing young people. So we are recruiting students from across the country to really get involved with the campaign and actually, one, become informed about the policy and how it's so critical that as a country we get behind federal climate policy, and secondly, actually lobbying their members of Congress in support of a...
So
Oregon Climate's co-director Camila Thorndike testified to the DNC platform committee in support of a carbon price. And subsequently, we actually, as you might know, there's a carbon price included in the Democratic Party platform, which is pretty exciting and a big deal that they're really taking a stance in support of comprehensive climate policy. So in that sense, we are paying attention. But we're also nonpartisan.
So my name is Mike Ewall. I'm the founder and director of Energy Justice Network. We're a national, slightly international, group that helps communities fight dirty energy and waste facilities like incinerators, landfills, power plants, all kinds of things, including biomass, biofuels, things that a lot of people think are actually green but aren't. I'm also one of about 20 people who co-founded the Energy Action Coalition that puts on this conference. We're not allowed to take positions on candidates, and as an organization, we do not do that. However, we're strong supporters of clean elections laws. This is not our organizational position, but personally, I'm voting Green Party for Jill Stein. She's the only candidate that is actually pro-environment. Hillary Clinton has done a ton of damage on that, and obviously Trump will be dreadful too, but for all the things that we fear about Trump, Clinton actually has a track record of actually doing it, and we can't support that. There's a clean energy march tomorrow that I'll be speaking at the rally before that march starts on nuclear issues and others.
I'm a delegate from Arizona for Bernie Sanders, and I am rooming with people that are involved in organizing this march. I am a high school principal, retired high school principal, and I've just seen so many brilliant kids who can't go to school because they don't have the money. I see kids on a daily basis who have catastrophic diseases and never seen a doctor, never seen a dentist. And in the richest country in the world, I think that's shameful. So that's why I feel the burn.
Okay. I'm curious to know, because it looks like Hillary Clinton is poised to become the leader of the DNC, and Bernie did endorse her. So how do you feel about that?
Anybody but Trump. Yeah, no, I like Hillary. I have always been an admirer of Hillary. So it was a tough decision, but I'm very happy with either one of them.
I'm Kendall Hale. I'm a member of Beyond Extreme Energy from Asheville, North Carolina. And we made this banner, Stop the TPP, stop or ban fracking, no drilling in the Gulf, and no eminent domain for private gain. And those are our hashtags to the public and to the DNC. Well, I think Bernie Sanders has on his platform that he wanted a ban on fracking, but that wasn't accepted by the Clinton platform. So, you know, I'm not real optimistic that she will do a lot to stop it, but I think possibly the drilling in the Gulf could be one.
My name is Lois Urso, and I am the email secretary for the Granny Peace Brigade. We decided to come today and tomorrow for the Poor People's March for Economic Human Rights. We'll be there tomorrow as well for that. We started anti-war, but we're anti-war social justice at this point. Clean power so that we are not polluting neighborhoods. And I find all too often they want to put plants in neighborhoods where there are high rates of asthma. I've already spoken to a few people that are here as delegates, and they have been reading signs. They have been looking around. And hopefully when they get to the point where they're voting on the floor of the convention, they'll think about that. They'll remember that. They'll remember what the people want.
I want to add something to that. I only see it as an opportunity because Bernie ran, and Bernie brought many opportunities to the to people all over the country.
I got the giant Bernie sign here. I know he's not the presumptive nominee for the Democratic National Convention, but I want to get his name out there. I think he's the best candidate for the job. Even if he doesn't win the nominee, I'll still be voting for him because I'm voting for what I feel is right for America. And that man's name is Bernie Sanders. If Hillary becomes president, I mean, I'm not probably not going to go move to Canada or something, get out of America. But at the same time, I don't feel comfortable living in a nation with someone, especially as lying, as cheaty, and greedy as she is, just she is, to me, part of the 1%. She wants to keep it that way. She is very corporate. She is very Wall Street. She was just paid by big banks to make speeches. And to me, that can't... I don't need a president like that. Like, same with Trump. You can't have someone with no qualifications running for president. And I feel like one of the biggest reasons she's so famed is because of Bill.
So can I just get your name and your background, where you're from?
Sure. Justin Coley, Birmingham, Alabama. And I work as a Spanish language interpreter and translator. I supported Bernie Sanders in the primary, although, to be honest, I was originally a Green Party, and I'm still a Green Party supporter. I'm concerned with the integrity of the electoral process in various states. I'm concerned with the way the primaries were held. And I'm also concerned about some of the perhaps underhanded tactics that seem to indicate there was some collusion between the party itself and the Clinton campaign.
What happens after Thursday if Hillary is the chosen one to go against Trump?
The Bernie movement will continue. There's no question about that. The thing about the Bernie movement is that it was the culmination of other movements that have been building and responding to crises, to insults and injuries and injustices for years now. And so that movement has found itself and connected with each other through a vehicle that was the Sanders campaign.
I'm a rat. I'm smarter than a dog, and I'm smarter than a cat. I'm a rat, and I'm for Bernie. And I will write Bernie in, because I'm not afraid of the big bad Trump. Who's afraid of the big bad Trump? Not me. I'm a rat. Ha, ha.
Bernie has apparently endorsed Mrs. Clinton. So where do Bernie supporters pour their energies?
Well, I'll tell you my hit on it, because I'm a spiritual brother. He has a man of integrity. When he committed to running as a Democrat, he committed to their rules. But I would love to see Jill Stein as president and Bernie run as vice president. Wouldn't that be a kick? Yeah. Rats united will never be defeated. The rats. You know, don't get me started. You know?
My name's Ashley Vaughn.
I noticed the sign you put in. Could you explain it?
Bernie or Jill Neverhill. I firmly believe that I'm not going to be pushed into voting for a candidate who I don't support. I don't trust her. I think that she's a liar. And I think that people need to be aware of the options that they have as far as third-party candidates go. So I don't see her as any better than Trump. She's not a better option. She's just as bad. I've got other options.
Yeah, my name is Connor. I'm from Atlantic City. And Bernie's a great step for people that are white in this country to help radicalize them. But for people of color, to be honest, I don't really believe, like, Bernie, like, I guess he wasn't in the front of their minds, you know? So I'm probably going to be voting for Jill Stein in the election. I'm still trying to work that out. Donald Trump is an outright white supremacist, but Hillary Clinton, you know, it's concealed. It's like it's always been in the North in this country. It's not in your face, but it's concealed. You know, you look at, like, the 2009 overthrow of the democratically elected leader in Honduras and replaced with a right-wing dictator, right? And she was a big part of that. And so was her VP choice, Mike Pence, who was actually a missionary in Honduras when that went down. So really, if we, like, look at, you know, Hillary Clinton's ideas and her beliefs, it's just hidden white supremacy. And so really, like, either way, you're voting to maintain a white supremacist capitalist corporate system. And so I think it's time to overthrow that system.
Why is the U.S. and Honduras in the first place? We have a responsibility here in the U.S. to call for justice for Mansa Cáceres. In this election cycle, for the first time, people are talking about feminism and women's issues. But my feminism doesn't mean that we go and invade other countries and assassinate their environmental indigenous leaders.
My name is Margaret Quatton, and I'm here with the It Takes Roots Caravan, which is a part of Grassroots Global Justice. And it's made up of 45 activists and organizers from around the country and Honduras. And we've gone from the RNC to the DNC, stopping in Pittsburgh and stopping in Baltimore to build with movement activists there because we know that, like, long after, you know, whoever comes into office, we're going to be dealing with the after effects of Trump-style hate, particularly the rise of, like, you know, white rage, and with Hillary-style militarism, particularly. On our caravan is Laura Caceres, Berta Caceres' daughter, who was a Honduras, an activist in Honduras who was assassinated on March 2nd. And so, particularly as a result of the U.S. intervention in Honduras and the coup that happened. So we're here to fight for justice for her, and particularly for a human rights bill that's going through Congress right now.
The United States finances and supports the Honduran government.
Con dinero para los militares y policía, pero también con entrenamiento.
Giving money to the military, to the police, but also giving them training.
No queremos esa ayuda, porque no es ayuda, es destrucción.
We do not want that kind of help. That's not help, that's destruction.
No queremos esas armas y no queremos ese dinero porque nos está matando.
We don't want those weapons. We don't want that money. It's killing us.
Por eso venimos acá también a pedirles a ustedes que presionen a sus gobernantes para que se pueda aprobar la ley Berta Cáceres para los derechos humanos en Honduras.
That's why we've come here also to insist upon you to contact your representatives and tell them they must support the Berta Cáceres law to cut off military and police aid to Honduras.
So the next person I want to bring up is
Jerry, where are you from?
He's been traveling around, inspiring me. He's been inspiring me for years. I really don't have to say much, but I want to be like you when I grow up. Danny Glover.
So, did James tell you to hear about it on the news?
Well, he did say something. I think I heard it
over the news. So, did you say?
I'm going to read some quote. We really feel like there's still an issue here in America. And we want to be able to use our platforms. We want to be able to use our voices. We don't want to let anybody silence us in what we want to talk about. So you guys, as you're talking about the press, ask anything about anything that's happening in society. That is Tanisha Wright.
Let me go up here so I can tip over.
Yeah. Mr. Right. Do you have any concerns about the way there's not enough being said about imperialism over the course of this election? Because that's a major concern right now in the world. And we're hearing a lot about climate, and we're hearing a lot about the possibility of a lesser evil, but where do things stand in terms of an imperial agenda? Libya, Syria, possible war with Russia. Is there a concern there that we can...
I think one of the things that is happening, and we have this opportunity in building this permanent revolution, is to broaden the whole conversation, the whole narrative, because imperialism has always been a part of it, whether it's the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and what's happening in Syria, the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya. And imperialism have always been the center point of U.S. policy. And it goes back entirely to its history, from its attempt to annex Cuba in the 1840s. So imperialism and expansionism has always been about that, control of resources. So how do we get to that conversation? How do we extend that conversation? We can talk about that conversation to some extent, because African descendants, more than 200 million African descendants, live in this hemisphere. And this is the year of the decade of Afro descendants designated by the United Nations. So I think there's a conversation happening. And out of those 200 million, as much as nearly 90% of them live under the poverty line. So there's a way in which we can hook our own struggles up to the struggles that we see as we deal with issues of climate change, as we deal with issues around the removal, immigration, and climate immigration, immigration by conflict, failed states. All those are part of the possibility, and our possibilities for deepening the conversation. Now, that's going to have to happen. We have to do that. The candidates are not going to do that.
That's a problem, of course, with the media. We've got so much of the message is being shaped by the mainstream media. So how do we get around that?
You know, I mean, but we've made some really strides in terms of reshaping the narrative and talking about some other things as well.
Thanks so much.
We can't fall prey to the same mistake that we made in the past. We had to use the new lesson. We had to use this positive energy. And I'm so proud of young people out here. But not just as young people. I'm talking about people who are baby boomers like myself who are out here as well. I'm so proud of y'all who are out here. Knowing that this is our moment. Knowing that we're on the right side of history. Knowing, as the great bard of the African-American community said, let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be a land where every man is free, every woman is free. That's the way the world we want to build. That's the relationship we want to build. Thank you for being here. Thank you.
The thing that attracted me to the Bernie Sanders campaign was that he wanted to use our money that we currently use for taxation and for spending, obviously, all this extra money that we spend in the trillions for infrastructure in this country, for education reform, and to better our livelihoods as American citizens. The one thing that really attracted me with him over, of course, all the other candidates was that he supported the people, and the people definitely support him. In lieu of all the things that are happening right now with the DNC chair resigning, them coming out of the woodwork with the WikiLeaks, of course, exposing the corruption, which we've kind of had an inkling of for the last year, really opens up your eyes. I mean, it opens your mind to the possibility that these delegates and these politicians do not represent us. They openly represent the major corporations that want us to rely on them for all our daily needs.
Yesterday, some people sort of grudgingly stating, well, you know, lesser of two evils. Is that your perspective?
Absolutely not. I think that if we are going to have a president, Democratic, Republican, or independent, I feel that it's important that they stick to their word and that we know where they stand in terms of policies. Hillary Clinton is very wishy-washy on her policies. You ask her something and she changes the subject, or she uses empathy to gain your trust as opposed to analytical thinking. And I feel like that's really dangerous, especially with a lot of the things that have been exposed lately, a lot of these major corporations backing her, the media backing her and slandering the other candidates as well. And you had the DNC chair resign because of corruption. They were rigging the election. They got caught. Look at all the NPP votes that were thrown away across the nation. Lots of NPP votes thrown away because they were Bernie supporters. Bernie taken off the ballot. It's very obvious. It's right there under your nose. You can just see that they are doing everything in their power to stop him from being the president because they know that he will act and he will give us the reform that the 99% need so that our country can flourish. And, of course, with the people coming out of the woodwork to protest against that corruption, I think that the superdelegates will open their eyes and see. I spoke to a few of them yesterday when they came in to a store. They were looking for Chromebooks because apparently they got hacked. And a lot of their data was exposed. And talking to these people, they even said that they were switching their support over to Bernie because they were under the impression that everything was being enacted fairly, and it wasn't. And once the exposure came out, you know, in plain's eye view, they were switching sides. So I think that today's vote really counts. It counts not only just for the Democratic Party, but it counts for the American people as well. I mean, if they want to defeat Donald Trump in the national primary, then they need Bernie Sanders. Clinton will be destroyed by Donald Trump because he has the support of voters. Clinton does not.
Can you say anything about the security presence here in the city? I mean, is it over the top? Is it enough? What strikes you as a resident of this city?
What strikes me is that you have military police in full flak gear looking like they're preparing for a blitzkrieg of some kind by U.S. citizens. When your party is exposed for corruption and then you have to put up sniper towers and 8-foot barbed wire concrete walls, you look bad. Okay, the same didn't go for the Republican National Convention. It was very open-ended. You were able to freely move around the convention, and they had their security presence there in Cleveland surrounding the building, but they didn't build barricades to prevent people from storming it. I think that that's a sign alone that they know they're in the wrong as well, and they're protecting themselves and their own interests from the rioting of American citizens. I mean, we've been in this recession now for over 8 years after the Bush administration left us in great debt. And you look at our cities, you look at the roads, you look at our schools, everything's crumbling around us, and the people have had enough. And I think that military presence, of course, is deserved in a way, because people are tired of these 1%ers telling the rest of us 99% what to do and how to do it. There needs to be reform, and it needs to happen yesterday.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. My name is Michael Welch. This week, we're featuring special coverage of the 2016 Democratic National Convention with a focus on the voices in the streets, with messages for Democratic Party delegates. The show is podcast at the site globalresearch.ca and airs on a number of partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. It also airs on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. Monday, July 25th, the start of the convention. A number of groups are organizing demonstrations today. Bernie Sanders activists have organized a march from downtown to the South End, where the convention is taking place. By the time the march arrives at the corner of Snyder and Broad Street, there are several hundred marching and chanting. Further down Broad Street, I see separate demonstrations. There's a group of maybe a dozen black people holding up signs condemning U.S. involvement in Haiti. There are also a number of individuals in a park adjoining Broad Street. They are holding signs and wearing different colored T-shirts.
My name's Laura Duncan. I'm here to protest Hillary.
Are you protesting Hillary?
I'm protesting Hillary.
Why?
She's a criminal. She should be in jail for treason.
Okay. So do you have any affiliation with the Democrats or the Republicans? Or?
Not anymore, baby.
Not anymore. So you used to be a Democrat.
I was a Democrat. I voted in the primary. I've been Democrat for 20 years. As soon as all this is done, I'm done.
Okay.
I'm going to vote for Jill.
Jill.
Jill Stein.
Okay. Were you a supporter of Bernie Sanders?
Oh, yeah, from the beginning. I've given him buttloads of money, and I did calling for him. I couldn't go out and knock on doors, but they've got the Bernie dialer, mm-hmm. where you numbers come up and you call people and talk to them. Every last person was for Bernie. I'm from Michigan. We voted for Bernie overwhelmingly.
Okay. Why? What is the appeal of Bernie?
He's honest. Probably the only honest politician in existence. And he's got good ideas.
Such as?
Oh, every last one of them. Down with the TPP. You better pay attention to climate change. My God, it's 96 degrees out here. 96 degrees. Something's wrong with the climate. Minimum wage. I can't remember everything.
So there's a march coming along?
Yep. Yeah, it's almost here.
Yeah, what can you tell us about it?
I don't know. It's big. It's bigger than it was yesterday.
Solidarity with Bernie.
Okay, so it's a pro-Bernie march.
Yep, pro-Bernie. Yep.
Okay.
And anti-Hillary.
Well, the DNC has been working with the media directly, and they've been working, you know, with other people in the DNC to knock Bernie down and lift Hillary up at the same time. Bernie got no media exposure throughout this whole thing. A lot of his exposure was from us. We are the media. We are the ones that put him out there. By posting it on Facebook, starting websites, starting groups, coming here, and coming to other places to protest for Bernie, doing marches. I mean, there was marches in Hoboken, New Jersey, close to where I live, all through the campaign. We're tired of money in politics. We're tired of things being bought. We are the people. The people are the majority, and we're the ones that make America great. It's not the rich. It's not the 1%. It's us. We're the ones that create the wealth in this country.
I still hope, against hope, that something's going to happen and Bernie's going to win. I still hold out hope. I still think I'm going to lose 30 pounds, too. You know, but I just hope. I'm going to cry if he loses. I'm crying now. It's so sad. He was so close.
and it was stolen from him. The whole primary was stolen from him. So I think that's it. They stole it. I'm sad.
Thank you.
If he wins, I will dance naked in the streets. Oh, my God, will that be
I was just wondering if you wanted to say a little bit about what brings you out to this protest and what it's about for you.
It's about cleaning up our politics, protecting our planet, getting corporate money out of everything that we decide. It's Bernie's message. It's immigration reform. It's criminal justice reform. It's everything.
Is this a protest against Hillary?
It's not against Hillary. It's against what she stands for.
Okay. And that's what she stands for.
She stands for profit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you based in Philadelphia, or are you an activist?
I'm from New York.
New York.
Yeah.
Okay. So you came down. Are you involved with either party?
I was Democrat? A Democrat. Yeah.
Was a Democrat.
Yeah. I wouldn't consider myself one now.
Okay. And that's because
they don't represent us.
Okay.
They
Okay. So, for example, when you say they fought against your voice.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you heard about the WikiLeaks things,
yeah.
But, I mean, everything, every instance of voter suppression is just good, laughing off of all of these people making this movement and calling Bernie and all the supporters. He's high in the sky, like crazy people, as if it's so much to demand equality and reasonable justice for people.
If she gets elected, in 100 days she'll do something for immigration. That's why, I mean, we try, like, every person comes and say, we want to
come in to fight to make this the last corrupt, billionaire-dominated voter suppression modern election we ever have to live through, or you're going to face massive disobedience every day of this convention.
Yeah!
When it said that it's time for the party leadership to pledge publicly that they will pass fundamental democracy reform in the first 100 days of a new administration.
Yeah.
That means voting rights,
yes.
An amendment to overturn Citizens United and public funding of elections,
yeah.
And prove their commitment to democracy by immediately abolishing superdelegates.
Yeah.
Yeah. In recent days, brothers and sisters, we've seen concessions in our direction. We've seen moves in our direction, and we got to celebrate that because that was driven by people power.
Yes.
We've seen Hillary come out and say she'll introduce an amendment to overturn Citizens United in the first 30 days. That's not far enough, but that's a win for the people. We saw them say, okay, we're going to reform superdelegates and take away two-thirds. We're going to have to follow the people. But no, that's not enough. But it's a sign of people power. It's a sign that we have to keep fighting.
Yes.
So now we're going to march down and we're going to show them we will not accept anything less than a democracy for all. Democracy, no democracy, yes, we will fight until we win that. We're going to send a message today.
Yeah.
Are y'all ready to march?
Yeah.
Is somebody ready to stand up?
A volunteering today with Democracy Springs. I am not really affiliated with them per se, but have been involved in nonviolent direct actions before. So I'm going to be helping with the jail support today, making sure that folks who signed up, got trained, filled out their info, and then actually showed up today get the support they need through that process over the next few hours today. Should be a pretty peaceful process. It'll be misdemeanors, like the highest level of arrest that it can be, which is basically like a parking or a speeding ticket. Just going to be a sit-in. And then the rest of it will sort of unfold as the day goes on.
To prove this, while they said it was a fair and neutral election, it was not. This has been rigged by Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the entire DNC. They have failed us, and now they want our votes for Hillary Clinton. That will not happen. We are here sitting in because we will never vote for a corrupt candidate that among other things, cannot beat Donald Trump. The only candidate who can beat Donald Trump is Bernie Sanders.
He looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
A young lady has just been, who's been sitting in, has been taken away by the police. Just as the sit-in's been going on now for about half an hour, I guess. 5 p.m. Thousands gathered right up front of this Wells Fargo Center gates at the AT&T station. Very spirited, proud in the heat. But it looks like a standoff right now. We'll see what's going to happen.
I'm Leah Cooper. I'm from San Francisco, Oregon originally, but I drove here from San Francisco with some friends of mine. We left on Wednesday. We got here Friday night. We're not delegates, but we came anyway because the people need to be heard. What's happening in this election is wrong, and it's about time somebody stood up and said something about it.
Could you talk, maybe give an example of what things going wrong within the election that you know about?
As I was saying earlier, just the fact that it's come down to two candidates that nobody likes, just that on its own should have everyone really angry and really upset. And then on top of that, just what I've witnessed myself and what my friends have seen in the process of working at the ballots, at the poll places, and trying to count the votes, and trying to keep track of what's happening with all of that stuff in California has just been hair-raising. We can't verify the vote. I mean, whether you believe there's fraud present or not, we can't tell, because the vote count is such a steaming pile of chaos and weirdness and incompetence that we can't even tell. There's no exit polls. A bunch of the provisional ballots that we had in California just kind of went missing. Some of them got rewritten without the presidential stuff on them. Some of them had whiteout on them. Like this whole, it's a gigantic mess. So we're here to support Bernie. And even though Bernie's kind of behind enemy lines right now and keeps trying to tell us to endorse Hillary, this is a movement and he's just... Bernie endorsed Hillary. There have been millions of people already leaving the Democratic Party. I myself have switched over to the Green Party, and if Bernie isn't an option in November, I will be voting for Jill Stein instead. Because, I mean, voting for the lesser evil kind of slows you down as you're circling the drain, but it doesn't give you any shot to get out.
Okay.
So it's about time people started voting for something they could actually believe in instead of just voting out of fear.
That evening, after a rainstorm had broken out, about 200 or so Bernie Sanders supporters maintained a presence at the barricade while cops on both sides, with paddy wagons ready, looked on. The protesters taunted the police, as well as exiting delegates.
I got involved firstly because I saw town hall meetings, which you can watch on YouTube, from the Arizona primary election. They cut the polling locations, so people, like there was 100,000 students for one polling location. There were people in the most populous county that waited 5-6 hours in line in the heat. A lot of people couldn't wait that long. Okay, and then they got up there and they found out they weren't registered in the party that they've always been registered in, and they didn't get to vote. And then they were given a provisional ballot and those weren't counted. Oh my God. I can't believe this is the country I live in. I really can't. So realize that I need to get up off my chair. I phone banked for the first time. I donated money. I went to New York. I canvassed. It was scary. I cried knocking on people's doors and asking them to listen to me. Some people weren't very nice, but some people were really nice, and that made it worth it. And that made me keep doing this. And every horrible thing that happened just strengthened my resolve and made me see how messed up our elections are. How can we fix anything if we can't even elect a good candidate? How can we fix anything if we can't elect someone like Bernie Sanders?
What happens to the Bernie Sanders movement if Hillary ends up becoming the de facto nominee? Is there anybody but Trump sentiment, or go to Jill Stein, or what?
Actually, I'm anybody but Clinton. I think Clinton is a dangerous war criminal and should not be a person in power ever again. I would never vote for Trump, but I think I might prefer him before her. I really do. I think she would do more damage on a global scale. So I think the movement continues, no question. A lot of people will go green, but the really special thing about Bernie Sanders was all the different kinds of people brought together under his umbrella. Like, I know Republicans that would support him if he were the nominee. A lot of independents. I mean, come on, he's an independent that's half our electorate, literally. All the Democrats. I mean, you don't talk to a single Democrat that says, no, I wouldn't vote for Bernie if he was the nominee. You get a lot of libertarians. You get all the Greens. I mean, if they just nominate Bernie, he wins in a landslide. He has the most energetic volunteer base you've ever seen. Way more than Obama.
Over the course of the program, we've heard significant opposition from vocal Bernie Sanders supporters to voting for Hillary Clinton. Many indicated they would sooner direct their vote to Dr. Jill Stein, who is the Green Party's nominee for president. Even more intense condemnation of Hillary was expressed the following day, Tuesday, at a march in the afternoon, which started in the north end of Philadelphia. This march was intended to be a black resistance march against the DNC and involved a coalition of groups denouncing police and state violence against black people, and particularly the Democratic Party's role in enabling that violence.
Well, Lee, what we see today is child play when they become adults. So let us represent the children. Let us speak on their behalf so they can really be entitled to freedom, justice, and equality. Thank you. All power to the people.
Legal observer with the National Lawyers Guild and also the protests. So the days that I'm not observing, I'm protesting.
Okay. Well, in terms of the issues at hand, there's a Democratic National Convention happening right now. What do you think that audiences should be keeping in mind with regard to Philadelphia and the elections and politics in general?
It all depends on the community that you're speaking about. If you're talking about the black community, which is my main focus, if you're talking about the black community, I think that the black community should keep in mind that neither party has done anything for the black community in this country. We just finished having 8 years of a black president, and 8 years of a black president has cost us more children in poverty, more black children in poverty than ever before. 8 years of a black president has cost us... We lost the most in the recession and have gained back the least. Eight years of a black president has cost us deaths of unarmed black men and women by police and vigilantes consistently through the 8 years with nothing to be done in place. People always talk about black-on-black crime and black-on-black violence, and they use that as an excuse to not talk about the repression and the oppression by state forces. And black-on-black violence is something that we have to deal with, but you deal with black-on-black violence by putting more opportunities in the communities where that violence is at. You deal with black-on-black violence by providing economic opportunity, by providing school opportunities, educational opportunities, by giving people options. Most of the violence is surrounded around the fact that there are little to no options in our communities. And that's not getting any better, no matter who the president is. It's not going to get any better with Hillary. It's surely not going to get any better with the Donald. So, you know, as far as my community is concerned, I don't know why, but we cling to the Democratic Party and continue to hope that they will do the right thing, which not, hasn't happened yet.
You're not feeling the burn?
I wasn't feeling the burn either. I wasn't. My thing is, you can't reform this, the Democratic Party, from within. There's no way of reforming it from within. And what happened to Bernie Sanders should be proof enough that you cannot reform it from within. What the way that we went after him, the way that they made sure that Hillary Clinton would win the election, is proof positive that you can't reform it from within. So you're going to have to start all over. You're going to have to start all over with a new party. You're going to have to start all over with people who care about people and not about profits. And both of these parties are now concerned about the 1% in their profits and what they can do to be the rule, what they can do be for a real ruling class in this country, which isn't the leaders, it's the 1%.
We do not need white sympathy.
We do not need white sympathy.
First name, but
sure thing.
I'm with the Real Justice Coalition. RIAL is an acronym, stands for Racial, Economic, and Legal. That's a local Philadelphia organization. That's why I'm here. My counterparts, my partners, have organized this, so I'm just out here to support. Today's march is specifically to speak out against police brutality to black and brown people. I'm a victim of that myself, even though I can't get too in detail with it currently, but, you know, yeah, we're speaking out against police brutality. Okay, we're all aware of Donald Trump and the negative things that he said, but Hillary Clinton has actually done negative things. She's put people in harm's way by voting to invade Iraq. She was a big component of that 2009 Honduran coup, and the ramifications of that are still being felt at this very minute. Very high murder rate in Honduras today. And she was partially responsible for that. So, yeah, we just want to speak out on all these things and convey how connected they are as well. You know, it's not just a black and brown thing. This is connected, you know. It's connected.
My name is Michelle Grant, and I'm the co-chair of the Philadelphia chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Okay. Are you aware of any specific instances of police misconduct or that have been brought to your attention during the or before the DNC?
Well, we are. I mean, and generally, the Philadelphia police for the past several years have been working on a strategy of demilitarization, unlike what was seen in Cleveland and especially in places like Ferguson and Baton Rouge recently. And they have been very willing to allow people to exercise their First Amendment rights and to do their marches, and they'll just do rolling roadblocks to prevent traffic accidents. We do have video of one person who was about to climb a fence and was sprayed with pepper spray, unfortunately, by a transit policeman. Our transit authority has its own police force. And one of them appears to have sprayed someone in the face when she was about a foot or two away from a fence before she was trying to climb it or doing anything. So that's going to be part of an investigation. We're also very concerned about the police shutting down the subway stop down there at the stadiums. We have one very long north-south bound subway, and the closest station to the stadiums, other than the one that they shut down, was almost a mile away. And the weather was extremely hot. I don't know the Canadian degrees for it, but it was, you know, it was 90 or 95 degrees Fahrenheit, and the heat index with the humidity was in the 100s and the low 100s. And it was dangerously hot, and yet they shut down the subway station when the Secret Service claimed that there was a security problem. And there were dozens and dozens of police around the stadium and around the station that could have done any kind of crowd control or credentials check and or so on when people were trying to get on the subway, but instead they shut the station down. And then kind of even more problematically than that, they were letting delegates into the station when they were not allowing protesters and demonstrators into the station, which that's a big First Amendment problem. It's a public utility, the subway, and they were preventing people from entering it just because they were going to be expressing something. And that's pretty fundamentally problematic for people trying to get in and out of that area, the Wells Fargo Center area.
Can you speak to other, call it irregularities with regard to policing around the DNC?
Well, we did see that if you were arrested for violating a federal rule, then you would get into more trouble than if you were arrested for violating a city rule. And that was very strange. And what happened was, this was called a national special security event. So this is a Clinton-era law that allows the Secret Service to declare special circumstances around a large event. This would be like the Super Bowl or the DNC, things like that. And so the Secret Service delineated a perimeter around the Wells Fargo Center down by that subway station. And at the first afternoon, evening, some demonstrators decided to hop a fence and get themselves arrested to make their statement, getting arrested as a statement. It was very peaceful and it was very calm, and it was a lot of media and a lot of noise around it, but it was done safely, and the people were given a citation. They were essentially just a ticket. Now we can argue about whether they were arrested because they were, moved away and taken away and then released, and they were detained for a little while. And if you're an absolutist about what arrested means, then you could say that they were arrested. But the city will say that they were not arrested because there were no charges filed. Then the next day, the Secret Service decided that that was a security problem. They extended the perimeter to where this previous fence was. And then so when people jumped the fence the next day, they were arrested by federal law enforcement, and they were taken to the federal facility. I forget if it was the lockup or if it was just the federal courthouse in Center City. And now they're facing federal charges. So the only difference between the people on the first day and the second day was that they were just arrested by different entities. They hopped the fence in the same area, but because the perimeter was changed and they were arrested by different people, now they're facing different consequences. I think it was 104 people who were given citations by the city of Philadelphia, and I think it was 9 who were arrested by federal law enforcement.
Is there any other elements of the with regard to the DNC and policing and the legal system that you really feel should be brought to the attention of the wider public?
On a constitutional level, we have what I like to call an Article 1 solution for this. So Article 1 of the American Constitution defines what the Congress can do, the legislative branch can do. And Congress has given this power to the executive branch in the Secret Service to declare these national special security events. Congress can say the Secret Service has too much power. Congress can say we're going to exercise our check on the executive branch and not allow the Secret Service to do these kinds of things, like extending these perimeters after they've already been established, like shutting down public transit for people who live and work here and are demonstrating here versus the visiting delegates. If Congress had not been sort of focusing for the past 8 years on being, insane about President Obama and focusing on what it has to do on its actual job, we could be looking at this executive overreach and we could be checking it. And I really wish going forward that Congress could look at these national special security events and say, why are we giving the executive branch so much power to interfere with the constitutional rights of our citizens? And people are unable to express their First Amendment rights, when the Secret Service comes in and shuts everything down like this. It's what we like to call a chilling effect. kind of the opposite with the heat, right? But it's a chilling effect if you think, well, yet last night, on Monday night, I went down and they shut down the train station. That really was a long walk back up to the Oregon station. So maybe I'm not going to go down on Tuesday and Wednesday night when the weather's going to be even worse. Well, that's a chilling effect. If you're deciding not to go and express yourself because you think the Secret Service, the executive branch, is going to be preventing you from getting on the subway, then you don't have as much of a First Amendment right as you did the day before.
Over the course of the last hour, we've been listening to the 2016 Democratic National Convention, Voices from the Streets of Philadelphia. It was recorded and prepared for radio by myself, Michael Welch. Part of the track Streets of Philadelphia by Bruce Springsteen was included. Global Research NewsHour airs weekly on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. Global Research NewsHour is podcast at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. My name is Michael Welch.